I just can't get enough of Millennial. Hope to see you guys in the live chat.
And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, welcome back to Millennial, everyone. Sorry about the delay in starting, there were some technical problems. But I'm now here with Martin Lichtmess, and one hardly knows the words to describe the intellect and the charisma of this hotly anticipated guest every year. Lichtmess, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Wolsey. I take the blame for all technical problems because I'm technically very retarded. I see you have expanded the description below my name. So I'm now, what am I? Austrian intellectual, Autor, Sprecher, Gothic Papst. I like that. Jetzt auch der Lichtspielführer. Okay, fine.
Do you want to explain each of those to people?
Yeah, I should. I mean, by the way, how's the technical side of it? I mean, are my moves looking a bit slowed down or something? You know.
A little bit, like an old silent film, with the frame rate is weird. We might have to switch off the cameras after a while.
I guess we should do it right now because my computer is just shit, you know. Not enough capacity. It always causes problems, you know. So,
okay. All right. You do that.
I know it's nicer when we have the images, but it would work better without, I guess. Yeah.
Okay then. Okay. Let me know if this works for you. Okay, I'll switch off mine, and you can switch off yours. There we go. Okay.
Good.
All right. Does this sound better?
It sort of irritates me to see myself in a silent movie slow mo. Now, so I can concentrate. I mean, I like being in a silent movie. I feel like a silent movie myself a bit. So,
right.
I'm fine, but you know,
yes.
Yeah. So, why should we get started this year?
Well, first of all, why don't you explain about Der Lichtspielführer?
Yeah, of course, it was clear we would talk about that. Some of your audience may have seen my appearance at Decameron, where I talked in length about it with Frody. So I didn't talk about the movie this time, but I introduced my upcoming book now, which is finally about to get printed. It didn't get released before Christmas. And Lichtspielführer is the title of the book. And it's a sort of, ironic title because Lichtspiel, a play of light, is an antiquated word for movies. So in the 1930s, you would say Lichtspiele, yeah? or a film director would be a Spielleiter, yeah? Something like this. And Führer, I know what many in your audience will think now, but in fact, the word in German means both guide and leader, right? So it's a guide, it's not a leader. So I am the leading authority on movies on the right. I declare myself as much. This is a huge project. I may have introduced it last year, I can't remember because it has been in the working for a while. It's a project I wanted to do for years. It's sort of movie guide, film seen from the right. I mean, should I really go into this now? I mean, we just started, so...
Yeah, okay, then, okay. I don't think you did talk about it last year, because I think it only got confirmed and you only started working on it around about April or May this year.
So, yeah.
But yeah, it is one that you've wanted to write for many, many years. And I remember it was, we always referred to it as Der Kinobuch, but then it got its actual title.
Well, you referred to it as Der Kinobuch because this is your way of German.
Yes, it's my level of German, yeah.
Yeah, and you no, it's not just the level of German, it's your special way of German. I mean, yes. I don't know if it's official the way it's called, or is it just an inside gag? I'm not sure if you should mention it, how it's called.
We can explain. We've got this thing called Bub Deutsch, because one of our mutual friends used to call me Bub. So I have this version of German which we call Bub Deutsch, which is just really crap German. And so sometimes I'll translate something badly into German, and Lichtmess will laugh heartily at my attempts at speaking his language. So yeah, that's an inside joke. But anyway, let's get to we can talk more about the book later, and I'm sure we'll talk about it next year when hopefully it will have been translated into English and people, you know, my audience will be able to buy it. But
right.
That's obviously a big project and something that's meant a lot to you. So I wanted to introduce it quickly. So let's get into it then. What kind of year has 2025 been for you?
Well, it brings me back to where I started, because it was mostly working on that book. Yeah, so I sort of disappeared into. I stopped my writing for the Secession blog because I just needed to focus, and I get so easily distracted. You know. Verzettelt, as we say in German. So I just needed to focus exclusively on the thing to get it done. And this is mostly what I have done. I mean, it was a good year, a not very spectacular one. And
there was also one important thing, is that you started an English Substack.
Oh, right. Okay. True. I did it in January last year, and the occasion was the death of David Lynch. He died shortly after our millennium. He died close to his birthday, 20th of January or so. And that sort of got me started. So I have a half a dozen pieces on it now. It also went into a slumber, you know, when I was writing the book, but you know, it will be reactivated.
Yeah, and people should subscribe to that. I've linked it on Rumble and Odyssey, but hold on a second, I'll link it on Twitter as well. And it's simply lichtmess.substack.com. Hold on a minute.
Yeah.
There we go on Twitter as well. That's something that I certainly encouraged you to do for quite a long time, because I thought that you're always popular on Millennial, so I thought it makes sense that it for you to have an English outlet online. So I hope people do take a look at that. There was also another of your early essays on there was about Nosferatu and the different versions of Nosferatu, 1922, 79, and then this new one. And I thought that was a great essay.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think this is the one that was the first. Yeah, this was the first piece. Then David Lynch, it was very dear to me, and still people tell me how much they enjoyed our legendary Halloween stream of, was it 22 or 21? I'm not sure. I think it was 21.
It was a long time ago, and we did intend to do more, but there were just every year there's been some obstacle that stopped us from doing it. But yeah, that was a very popular stream. It's on my Odyssey. People can find it there. We did.
We talked about Dracula. Yeah. It was. I remember it was just improvised. You know, I just was in the mood for it, and I have this long time obsession with Dracula movies, and we just went on and on, and I listened to it a bit, and I think we did a great job. And people liked it because we were enthusiastic about what we were talking about.
Exactly. I mean, I think we both love, well, you love all three of those films. I've got a lot of fondness for Nosferatu and the remake, but I really love the Coppola Dracula. I think it's just such an interesting and unique film. So, yeah, that was lovely. And what we were going to do was do an equivalent stream for Werewolves, Witches, and Jekyll and Hyde, I think. And there's another one.
Yeah, Ghost Stories.
Yeah. Yes, and Frankenstein as well, of course.
All the monster show items. But I think we announced one about Ghost Stories. There was one we wanted to discuss, the one you recommended to me, The Signalman, which was one of those BBC drama. But yeah. Then there was some technical, I don't know, I just don't remember. We just, but maybe next year, folks, maybe next year. And I did read some English ghost stories this autumn. I had a volume of M.R. James and...
I had the very same. I think you somewhere I saw a photo of you. You must have posted a photo of it. Somewhere.
Yes, I posted the photo.
I had the exact same book in the 90s. It was the Wordsworth Classics, and that was where I read M.R. James. So it was funny to see.
It's a 1990s edition. Absolutely the same. I don't know where I got it from, and. It was great, you know, really great stories. But I was disappointed in the foreword. M.R. James says that he had never experienced any such thing, and he doesn't even know anybody who has. So I thought, like, come on, just lie about it at least, you know, for your audience.
Well, yeah, I know what you mean. I know there's a similar thing. There's a guy in British TV called Nigel Neal who wrote a lot of science fiction. And he not only did he say that he didn't believe in it, but he actually said that he thinks people who do hope that these things are true are idiots.
Come on.
Yeah.
Insult your audience. What the hell?
I know. I was quite surprised. But he was a very talented writer. Mind you, I showed you one of his things and you didn't like it, The Stone Tape. And I don't think you liked that.
No, I liked it. But I wasn't as enthusiastic as you were about it. It was a good story. It was a good TV show. But you were so enthusiastic about it that, you know, I was a bit not so much. As
well,
it was good. No, it was good. Absolutely.
What about The Signalman? Did I overhype that?
No, not at all. It's a great ghost story. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Everyone likes The Signalman.
Mm. Yeah. But I wouldn't just talk about The Signalman, but, you know, go into ghost stuff as well. I mean, the thing is, I'm not at all personally. I'm not at all saying there are no such things, and I haven't experienced them firsthand, but I know people who have, and not just people who are fantasists, I mean, people who are down to earth, very rational, and they told me about strange apparitions and eerie, you know, things you can sense but you cannot see. The thing is, when I read ghost stories, it gives me more excitement to think at least some of it could be possible, maybe not as perfect or as spectacular as in an M.R. James story, but just a bit, you know. Just otherwise, it wouldn't be so much fun for me if I thought it was just fantasy, you see.
Yeah, exactly. I of course, part of you wants this stuff to be real. I don't know.
I want to believe. Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, well, I think we should try to do more of those streams because I think it was a lot of fun and it was very popular.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that can excite me as much as vampires when it comes to horror. I think vampires are groovy, they're cool. I loved them as a kid. I used to dress up as Dracula when I was age 9. I have a friend who did the same. She went to school dressed as a vampire, and people had to send her to a psychologist. I mean, she was, I know, a kid, 8-9 years old or so. And I guess she did need a psychologist. So, but I don't know what to tell you about your psyche if vampires attract you more than any other horror figure.
Yeah, I don't know. I was never into them that much. But I did think RoboCop was extremely cool.
Yeah, well, that would be Frankenstein, that kind of direction, you know.
Yes.
I mean, it's basically the same story, you know, a very similar story, because this was the trouble of the creature, that it was too human, but not human enough, you see. And this is what made it so spiteful, you know, against its creator. And RoboCop does have similar problems, I think.
Yes.
It's hard to be a cyborg. No, I wouldn't want to be a cyborg.
No. Well, and then there's also the problem of memories coming in from the previous life, and you don't know what to make of them.
Yeah. But isn't it witches you are scared the most about?
I mean, yes, I think that's the most interesting of these ones because it's so realistic. I mean, I think we've all known in our lifetimes, we will all have known some woman who was, you know, twisted and nasty, evil. And I'm sure that that's the basis for it in real life. It would be the woman in the village who was horrible to everyone. There's a degree of reality about it. Go on.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you know, you go on.
Well, it's scary because it's a woman who isn't full of care and, you know, empathy and love and so forth. That she's not caring. That's horrible. That's really scary. Because there's something fundamentally wrong about that. So, yeah, that's... I mean, obviously, there are more to the witch archetype than that, but that's what I find so scary about it, is this idea of a, like, demented, nasty woman. Of course, I'm now reminded of the woman in The Shining, the bathtub, where she's coming out and there seems to be nothing in her mind at all except evil. That's the similar sort of thing. So, but that's a whole other thing. And we should get into that when we do a stream about it.
Right. We shouldn't waste our bullets now, because I have a lot of ideas about what you just said, but we can talk about other things. I guess people want to hear about politics, or what do they want to hear about, do you think?
Yes, I would say so. The events of the year generally is what people talk about in Millennial. And I know that people always very much value your contributions in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But you'd rather talk about horror stuff, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. But the problem is I was already getting warm, you know, I warmed up, you know, so all right. So, I mean,
well, but we could combine the two by talking about Ursula von der Leyen.
Just what came to my mind, you know, exactly. I had her in mind, and I had Angela Merkel, and there are lots of witches in contemporary politics, you know. Terrible.
I actually just saw a clip of, I think it was her, and it was shared by Aureus, and I just watched it an hour ago, and I thought that this stupid bitch, she's going on about the need for censorship and pre-bunking. So I don't know what that means in practice, but she was saying to vaccinate people against this info.
Yeah, okay. The facts are settled, you know, so you can already pre-bunk them before anybody comes and challenges them, right? They are just written and carved in marble forever, you know, according to... Yeah, this is a horrible... And people always talk about how... I'm really annoyed about the thing about how the world would be a better place if you had more women in politics, you know? And but when you say, okay, I want Alice Weidel or I want Marine Le Pen, then they say, nah, not those, you know, not those. They think of people like Merkel or Ursula, you know, they're just awful people. Yeah.
And hold on, I found this clip. Yeah. It was actually the TBG who shared it. So I'll play this now. And the conclusions are obvious. It's just crazy to have these women and give them any power at all. No one will be surprised by that. But what? Right. I'll just play this. Okay, here we go.
And finally, it takes results. As technology evolves, we need to build up societal immunity around information manipulation. Because research has shown that pre-bunking is much more successful than debunking. Pre-bunking is basically the opposite of debunking. In short, prevention is preferable to cure. Perhaps if you think of information manipulation as a virus, instead of treating an infection once it has taken hold, that is debunking. It is much better to vaccinate so that the body is inoculated. Pre-bunking is the same approach. Because disinformation relies on people passing it on to others. It is essential that people know what malign information's influence is and what the techniques are that are behind it. And as the knowledge goes up, our chances of being influenced goes down. And that builds up the society resilience that we will need.
Fucking hell, I hate you for showing me this. You are a sadist. I mean,
sorry.
I want to burn her at the stake now. I mean, and you as well for showing me this. Oh god. I mean, she should be pre-bunked as well. Okay, these people, they talk, of course, resilience is a word for psych bubble word. So they use it about their system. You know, their system should be resilient, their system of power. That's what they're talking about. It's the same when they say our democracy, you know, which means our little power system, you know, where we are in charge and nobody questions us and nobody challenges us. And this pre-bunking, this is so, it's almost genius, you know. Pre-bunking, what the hell? She should have been pre-bunked before she got the power.
it's also note the language of COVID there. Yeah, this is
totally. This is what triggered me. This is what triggered me the most. You know, this turned me into a witch burning mood. You know, it's your fault now, okay? I mean,
I'm sorry. I saw it about an hour ago, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. It just came up here. I thought I was reminded of it. But it's the language of COVID being, you know, used for something else 5 years later. And you get this sense that it's like she and her colleagues have latched onto this idea, and they're excited about it. It's the next way that they'll guide the public. It's the next tool that they'll use to shape public life. And they are obsessed with this. I mean, they are obsessed with shaping public life in a way that our leaders in previous eras weren't, I don't think. They're very much concerned with what the public, with the public getting out of control. So on the one hand, they despise the public, but on the other hand, they're obsessed with what the public are thinking. It's a weird sort of schizophrenic attitude. I think they see the public as just a mass that just has to be controlled, but they despise us.
Yeah, I despise them as well, and I'm not being controlled. So the thing is, you know, last year, I mean, I have been thinking, analyzing, watching these kind of people quite a lot in my life, thoroughly. I mean, it's interesting if we remember the years of COVID, you know, when we had millennials. These dreams are already historical now. I think I would rewatch them if I wasn't afraid of post-traumatic trauma triggers, because this was kind of our Vietnam, you see. And so I don't want to go back there for a long time, but certainly this is now a time capsule, and the nature of power manipulation became very transparent at the time, and now you cannot unsee it. You see this in this clip, you see just the lingo, you see the attitude, it's all still there, you know? But I don't think it's so much, they don't have as much power as they used to have, in my opinion. I don't know what you think.
Oh, I think it's all falling apart. I agree with you.
Yeah.
I mean, they would need another public health crisis like COVID wasn't, in order to justify, in order to hold it all together. I think that it's partly because of Trump and all that in America. I also think it's just the sheer mass immigration since COVID. I think the public are just drifting away from these people, and they're left kind of stranded. I mean, they still have their positions and all the money and the resources, but I think they're so distant from ordinary people that there's no hope. I don't think it can be rescued. And I think this is why they want a war with Russia. This is one of the reasons they want a war with Russia, because that would be another huge crisis. That would,
but it failed, you know. Yeah. It's sort of failed, you know. It's this fucking war is just stuck. It's a huge tragedy. So I don't know. The thing is, maybe I'm being very subjective here, because the main thing for me in 2025 was that I disconnected with all that for my own good. You know, it just felt good for me to. You know, go back to my roots with the film stuff. And this is something, you know, I would like to talk the most about this time, because not just the film book, you know, but also the role of culture or cultural things, you know, within all this, you know, political context that is ruled by Ursula and other people. I mean, this also has the arts, you know, looking at the arts has always, regarding the arts, has always been a source of relief for me, you know, or a sort of remedy, you know, or also a source, you know, a source of strength. This is something that was the main theme for me this year, you see, not necessarily this problem about, you know, the typical metapolitik but the political doctrine of how culture ties into politics, how culture is a tool of politics, how you first you have to win over the culture and then you change the politics. I mean, it's an old thing. It used to be one of the slogans from, I think, Breitbart picked it up, you know, the original Andrew Breitbart, when he said politics is downstream of culture, you see, if yeah. I remember it correctly. So many people understood that thing, and it's certainly right. But the one thing also that has to be clarified is that if you just see culture as a tool only, then you are on a wrong track. You know, then you will not get very far, in my opinion. And another thing is that some days ago on Twitter, it came to my mind. I said something like, today, all true art is post-cultural. And I added, I don't know yet what I mean by that. So I have to figure this out, because, I mean, we can go into that. I mean, this is much what is on my mind, much more, you know, than, you know, wanting to burn Ursula Lein at the stake, which I won't. I don't. It's just a joke, you know, if you're listening to anybody, you know. I'm not actually want to burn Ursula Lein at the stake. I just want to send her to a prison island somewhere. I don't know. make her clean toilets. Heiko is a memory of years ago. You know, you still remember that guy. You know? So we have.
I know.
Okay, audience, we have Wolsey and I. We have this inside joke about Heiko Maas, who was what the fuck was he actually? He was a minister of the interior, I think, in Germany.
Yeah.
And he was responsible for all this, you know. Surveilling, you know, fighting the right wing, controlling the internet and blah, blah, blah. And the guy looked like Eichmann, you know, which was pretty funny. You know, he would say lines like, it's because of Auschwitz I entered politics. I said, yeah, so did Eichmann. Yeah? So there was a joke about him looking like Eichmann, and he was fighting Nazis very hard. And so we made a joke about Heiko always watching over our conversations. And whenever I say something naughty, then Heiko, it was just a joke, Heiko. No, I don't know what the dude is doing right now these days. I haven't heard from him in years, you know. He's probably retired. This is what these people all do, you know. Politicians today, they cannot be held responsible for what they do. After they have run their office, you know, the time is up, then they just do something else and disappear. And they have caused damage and done stupid things, but they just float, you know. They just float like fat in a soup, you know. And so much for that. This is our Heiko Maas inside joke.
Hold on, I've got a photo of him. There he is.
Yeah, but he should be wearing glasses. You know, then he looks more like Eichmann. Yeah, okay. Yes, Heiko, yes, we are few. I mean, probably everybody else has forgotten about him. It's just you and me making jokes about him. You know, this is how this fucker, sorry, would go down into history, you know, as the butt of our jokes, which he deserves, you know. So, the people that followed him, they were no better, you know, but he was just more fun to make fun about it. I mean, Heiko Maas, what kind of a name is that? You just make fun out of the name. Yeah. And then we had this bitch. Yeah, sorry. I wanted to talk about something highbrow, and here I am, you know, bashing, you know, politicians from years ago.
part of the joke here's a different one of him. Part of the joke was that he was so small. There was a photo of him with a pair of like big lesbians or something, and I can't find it now. But he was this. He was apparently in charge of all the hate speech stuff and monitoring, surveilling people and all that. And I wouldn't trust him with that job. But anyway, I won't bring up Heiko again.
Yeah, okay, so much for Heiko. Just because I disclaim here, I don't want to actually burn Ursula von der Leyen at the stake, even though she's a witch, you know? Or maybe this is the origin of witches, people like her or so. Could be. but this is the thing. All these people have become a joke for me. I mean, I just don't care about them. So I needed to go somewhere else. You know, I mean, the thing is, I was a bit drained when I started last year, and also I was a bit annoyed. I wasn't really enjoying much what I was doing. Last year, for example, last year around Christmas time, there was another Arab brown person driving a car into a Christmas market in Magdeburg. I think we may have even discussed this or mentioned it last year, if you remember.
I think I talked about it with Martin Sellner, but I think it might not have happened when you were on. I can't remember now. I don't know. Has there been anything like that this year? I can't remember. See, there's so much stuff that goes on that you just forget. At the start, at like 2015, each of these incidents was memorable. It was distinctive. But at this point, it just seems to be almost every month there's a pretty big incident like that.
This is what I was getting at, and also I wrote a piece about it, and I had this feeling of déjà vu, like, oh God, another one. You remember, I think there was this one story in 2016 in Berlin, but lots of awful stuff have happened. So there are all these collateral damage of multiculturalism, and then I feel like I was writing the same piece all over again, and I see nothing changes. You know, people would always hope, there's a shock now, people will wake up. No, it doesn't happen. You know, people just forget it. It goes on. You have these predictable reactions to it, and so I just really had enough of that. You know, I mean, I wasn't writing just about stuff like that. I mean, last year I had a huge variety of issues I was writing about, lots of stuff. I started writing about magic, it got me interested, I read Aleister Crowley, and I wrote about veganism. I thought this was pretty interesting, I wrote my book, my anti-smartphone book. This was published this year. I have this book critical of the spread of smartphones, but this is the thing I don't want to talk about because it gets me into a bad mood. I'm glad I have written this book, So,
I'll say this. The two of the essays that I've written this year that I'm most pleased with are about their TV guides to TV series, Rising Damp and New Scotland Yard. And I find myself going back to them and reading those two essays a lot because it's upbeat, it's pleasant, it's something that I like. So I do understand. I mean, I can be very proud of an essay about, some horrible topic. I can be very proud of it, but I won't necessarily enjoy reading it in the way that I would enjoy reading about it. Something that I like.
Yeah, there we go. You got it.
It sort of drains you to talk about negative stuff so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the kind of trap I was getting into, and I mean, it's a bit like looking into the abyss for a bit too long. So I need to find things that are more enjoyable. And this film book was the thing I had planned for a long time. And I needed to sort of get, shall we talk about this now? I don't know. We can get into it if your audience is interested or if you're interested, we have talked in private a lot about it. So you may get bored by what I say because you already know what I'm going to say.
That's okay. Mm. That's okay. Let's go for it then. Let's talk about.
I try to give it a bit of an Yeah, I try to give it a bit of an interesting angle.
Just before you start, do you want me to put up the original cover design for it?
Which one you mean? The original, the black one?
No, the jokey one that I made.
Okay, make the jokey one.
Okay, hold on a minute. I'll find it for people. But this was actually years ago when Lichmes first mentioned this, the possibility of writing this book. And I made this this joke cover for it. So here it is. But obviously that's not serious. Yes, exactly.
So, and do you have the black cover now at hand, the one that's going to get printed? It's based on your design, right?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. I designed a proper version. Hold on a second. Right, yes, I think it's this one. So this was years later when the book had been written. I designed this.
Yeah.
So there we go.
It's roughly gonna look like this. Not exactly like this. There are a few changes, but this is the basic concept. Yeah. And you see, the authors know there are drawings. They're being made by an artist I know. Really beautiful drawings to illustrate the book, and also a drawing of me. And this were also important for me to include that. It's a sort of anti-AI statement to have real, you know, craft and art in it. And you can order a special edition of the book where you get fine prints of these. It's not like movie posters. So I have chapters that are devoted to certain topics. You know? So I have, for example, topic of nation, of religion, of multiculturalism, dystopias. I have myths and legends, yeah, conservative heroes and all that. So these illustrations are designed like movie posters where you have this collage or collection of characters. And here on this cover, you see on top you have Excalibur, John Borman. You see the Lady of the Lake. She offers the sword, you know, the magical sword to King Arthur. The actor is Nigel Terry, I think. My memory. Okay, so and then we have Robert De Niro, taxi driver. Below we have Daniel Day-Lewis, Gangs of New York. So it's just a coincidence there are two Scorsese characters on the cover, but these are iconic images. Then we have Withnail from Withnail and I, which I know is a film you are very fond of. The woman on the left is Maria Callas in Pasolini's Medea. She was a famous opera singer. And in this film, she doesn't sing and she doesn't even speak. Even in the Italian version, she was dubbed. but she's great. Then we have an actor called Ken Ogata, and he plays Mishima in the film Mishima, Life in Four Chapters by Paul Schrader. And this is the only Asian film I have included because it's basically a American production shot in Japan. But, you know, in order to limit the scope of the book, I had to exclude Asian cinema, especially Japanese cinema, which is, you know, marvelous and relevant for right-wing issues. So I'm focusing on, let's say, the white world, you know. So I have Russia, America, and Europe, and so, and this is what I focus on.
I think this might be the final cover, the real one. So there.
That will be the final cover, but I have never changed that. On the top there will be another figure, you know, but I haven't got it available now. Yeah, but this will be the final cover, and the other one you designed, there was a different format for it. Yeah? So it's a rather large book. It's really lavishly produced. Inside you also have movie posters from the films, which you could use without copyright. And I'm discussing about 100 films, which I think would be, you know, important from a meta-political or a right-wing angle. To my own surprise, I found lots of more politics in it than I thought. You know? But of course, I thought it was important you have to focus on the art of films. You know? This is also, I chose very different films from different eras, different countries. So you can see that you can have many, you know, perspectives on one subject, you know, not only in terms of content, but also in terms of form. And ideally, you know, form is what creates content. And this was important for me. So I just wanted to set an example. And when I say film seen from the right, I use it in a very broad term, you see. So included the whole, let's say, the whole writing spectrum, you know, films that would be relevant, you see, for, let's say, white nationalists as well as for libertarians, you know, or films for, you know, more liberal conservatives. So because these boxes,
it's important. It's important to state that this is not a list. Like the book doesn't contain a list of like the most right wing films or something like that.
Yeah,
I think you should clarify that.
Yeah, absolutely. These are the things that first, it's not a list of the most right wing films because first, I don't think there is such a thing. This is very a very subjective thing to say, and of course, you should not use two narrow ideological frameworks to judge the films. This is, I have mentioned a few bad examples in my book, how not to do it. I mean, one thing I stumbled upon while I was researching was, there's a website called Conservapedia, and it's written by American, you know, mainstream conservatives, and they had a list of the 100 worst liberal films, you know, and it was so atrocious. I mean, it was funny. For example, they included A Space Odyssey because it promotes atheism and evolutionary theory. So we're on that kind of level. You know? And these are guys who also thought the Nazis were liberals, you know. So they included films like The Eternal Jew or Triumph of the Will. You know, these were some of the most worst liberal films, you know, shit like that, you know.
My God.
Right. You see these American mainstream boomer conservative Christian conservatives, and they were judging the films only with ideological terms, and it's just awful, you know, awful, awfully stupid. So this is a bad example how not to do it. And I often talk about the political background of filmmakers or actors because it's relevant, but this is not the most important thing about it. So I have this formula that sometimes the artist within a filmmaker is more clever than the ideologue. So there might be artists who have all kind of, you know, leftist ideas in their head, but when they work as artists, then something else comes out of it, you know, something that is deeper, more complex, more relatable, also open to interpretation, you see. And this is also what interested me, that once the film is, you know, out, done, and then it belongs to the audience, and the audience can adopt it and can, you know, read or see things or like things that the filmmaker didn't necessarily intend, right? And so I think it's important to have this flexibility. And when I say right wing, then okay, I accept the label right wing, whatever that means now, I'm not sure, okay? So it's in fact, in the end, my personal view, you see, and this is why it's called Lichtspielführer, Lichtmess, and also I'm in the center to make sure it's just a subjective personal view. This is the way I see these films. And of course, I try to understand what the films are trying to say, you know, what were the filmmaker's intentions. This is one level, you know, but the next level is, what do I think of it? And how may the audience perceive it, you see? And this was basically the basis of it. So it's also not necessarily the best films. You know? If I would make a book about my favorite films or the films I think are the best, it would be a different book. You know? So I just pick a topic and I say, now watch these 10 films and they tell you something about it, you know. And sometimes these films are very well known, sometimes they are obscure. This is also a thing that I enjoyed, that I have a big,
remit.
Yes, so I can include blockbuster mainstream classics, but I also can include lesser known films. I can include completely obscure stuff. And this is also something I enjoy. Making people discover things, because this is something I like as well, when people can show me things, when people or when I was a young cinephile and I discover, I had a film guide. I also had a film guide when I was 12 years old, and there were all these films in it, and back then it was hard to see them because you did not have internet. You had to wait when they were aired at TV or when they were shown at some cinema, or maybe they got a VHS or maybe later DVD release. So I like to discover things. I like people to show me things and recommend them to me. And I also like to do the same. And I realized that it's necessary already. So some stuff I took for granted, like, oh God, everybody knows that film, you know, everybody knows this one and this one. And then I see, oh, maybe that's not the case anymore. I remember that I was, I also mentioned this when I was talking to Frodi. I had this discussion with a very young, internet radicalized Zoomer guy, and he knew all about Kevin MacDonald, you know, but he didn't know who Stanley Kubrick was. And so then at least, he had seen some clips from Full Metal Jacket. So you see, some of these films, they get, put memed, the memes are clips. They are all over the internet and people recognize them, but few people actually, watch them or know them. And so this is what I'm doing here. I say, look at this, look at that, And this was part of the fun of it.
I think what you say about is very interesting, that a film can mean something or suggest something that the director didn't intend. Because when I wrote the Withnell speech in 2017, and I put it up on, I did the speech and recorded it and put it up on my YouTube channel, there would be comments from left-wingers, from liberals, outraged that I was talking about this film that they liked. And outraged that I was reading conservative right-wing stuff into the film, that I was taking conservative messages from the film. And it was so interesting. It was, they couldn't conceive that, basically they couldn't believe that a right-winger could be thoughtful. And therefore they couldn't conceive of a film eliciting right-wing thoughts. Because to them, the writer just brain dead, and they own all thought, they own all the intellectual space, and there's no way that you could watch Withnell and I and legitimately take right wing ideas from it. But to me, it's just obvious that the film, it's in some ways it's liberal, but in some ways it's guiltily right wing, is guiltily conservative, because it's saying you have to try, you have to belong to something, you have to honor your ancestors, you have to honor traditions, you have to try to live up to them. Because what you see in that film over and over again is that the young are not living up to their ancestors, and the result of that is personal failure for them. Obviously there's more to it than just that, but you can definitely see that in the film. So to me, as I say, to me, that's obvious. But to them, it was completely alien. I mean, to them, when Withnell and Marwood lament the end of the 1960s and we have failed to paint it black, To me, what that means is it was an impossible dream and a stupid dream in the first place, and human nature got the better of you. But to liberals, what it means is that, oh, we didn't try hard enough. You know, real 1960s has never been tried, kind of thing.
Yeah, right. Before we continue, maybe you can remove the cover now of the book. Okay, good. Yeah. I mean, this is a very good example. And of course, my perception of the film was very much influenced by your speech, which was one of your best. And it took me a while to get, it took me three times, you know, I attempted to get into this film. The third time it clicked, you know. So sometimes films take a bit of patience, you see. You need to dedicate yourself to them to open up, and especially if they are from, I mean, the access is more easy for you because it's a British film, you know, and it speaks of very British things. You mentioned this in your essay and pointed this out a lot. So I needed some, you know, explanation, you know, to get into deeper into it, you know, because you can perceive it on some level or another. And so it takes an effort. And this is something I pointed out I choose often films that are difficult to watch. You know, maybe some people will hate me for recommending them, but I like difficult films to watch, and because the payoff can be huge. You know, some films are, you know, I mean, you also have to sometimes watch films that are painful for one reason or another. I mean, I wouldn't recommend a film. I would say it's dull, it's badly made, you know. But sometimes you have to put a bit of an effort into it. And then you can see it as death in Whistle and Eye. And I think this reaction of leftists there, I mean, they're panicking because first, I mean, they conceive us as stupid, you know. They don't believe that right-wingers can say, they are really disturbed when we say anything clever, you know, anything that rings true to them, or when we have different views. And this is also what I want to do with that book. I want to annoy the people on the left who think culture is all on their side. You know, culture is a left-wing thing, and it's increasingly less so. You know, I mean, I told you I needed to have some sort of, you know, it's always good if you have some adversary. You know, it creates a tension. And I had an imaginary adversary, and I showed you this guy. There's this leftist film critic who has built up a huge channel on YouTube, and his name is Wolfgang Schmidt. And and he's an old school leftist, which means he doesn't like wokery. I must say he has rather good taste in films. So he knows what he's talking about, but also I find him very annoying on many levels, right? I mean, of course, he's doing basically the same thing I do. He's using a sort of, you know, ideological framework, which has to be, you know, flexible. It must be too rigid. And he looks at the art of the film, and his framework is basically a Marxist one. I mean, you can see things through a Marxist lens. It's not all wrong, you know, I have to say, but it's limited, you know, it's a limited view. It gets boring after a while because it becomes, you know, a formula. And so I thought this guy, I want to challenge guys like these, you know, because this guy's also a bit pompous and vain, and he put out a book of film reviews, which was 700 pages, and I thought, okay, first, you can cut this book into half at least. There are so many films that are just not that interesting. I mean, I like to read a few, I like to read what's the English word if you have a bad judgment on a film? Is there a word? We say Verriss in German. If you have a bad judgment on a film, if you bad review, if you
condemnation, criticism.
Yeah, Or is this word a pan a film?
Oh, yes, if you pan a film, yes.
Yeah, right. So I like a good pan of a film. It can be very fun to read. But, you know, this guy, he just, he watches the output of films constantly, and he reviews every shitty superhero film or mainstream film, and I just think cinema in these days isn't that good to deserve so much attention.
Right.
So
that would make you hate cinema. If I was, my God, I can't imagine that, having to watch those fucking trashy Marvel superhero films over and over. I've never even watched one of them. I've watched clips from them, and every time I'm stunned at the stupidity and shallowness of them. They're just, it's absolute trash.
Yeah, I think every thinking person agrees they're crap. You know, I mean, what does it mean for a culture if these are the most successful films, culturally relevant? There was only one I saw and reviewed, somewhat tongue in cheek. It was the Black Panther film, if you remember. And I thought this film was hilarious on many levels because it was this, you know, unfettered black nationalism in it. And also, yeah. I think it's hilarious that you get Wakanda is just fun. I mean, it's the Vivos, you know, Vivos astronauts, or I don't know, Vivos, whatever, you know, meme. And so I wrote a review on it where I was praising this film as a, wow, this is a truly alt-right. This was the heyday of the alt-right, you know, 2017 or so. 16, I don't remember. So, Everett, this is the first true alt-right film, and it's an identitarian film. And this guy, Wolfgang Schmidt, he read my review, and he agreed with me, you know, because he was this critique of identity politics from the left, you see. And this is what makes him a bit more interesting than the woke people. He's much more clever than the woke people. He would say, look, the right-wing people have realized this is a identitarian, you know, racist film in a way, you know, and he thought I was seriously praising it. I mean, it was fun, but I wasn't seriously praising it. It's not a great film. It was just a symptom of the times. And this is something that justifies watching to some extent, you know, it justifies watching also contemporary bad films so you can maybe see a bit what's going on in culture. But I have to say, I don't really believe this is as valuable as it might have been long time ago, because films do not reflect culture as much anymore as they used to, partly because of this thing that pop culture has disintegrated, collective culture has disintegrated. This is a subject I'm going to deal with in my next book, which will be a sort of follow-up or companion to the movie book, where I talk a bit more about the frameworks, how films are perceived today, how films made today, what would be the future of films if you have this AI thing going on and all that. This is on my mind, and this is something I want to get clear about, you see. So I think it may have been, let's say 15 years ago, it may have made sense if you watch all the stupid mainstream films and it can tell you something about the culture. I think today, not really. I mean, there's this new Avatar film out there, and I have no intention whatsoever to watch it. And this, I don't know how, these Avatar films are reportedly the highest grossing films in world history or whatever. Now, at least they make a lot of money, lots of people watch them, but I don't see that they do have an actual cultural impact. You know, I don't see that they actually matter. You know, I don't think that they really enter our minds as films used to do.
That's true of the first Avatar film as well. So, which I think was 2009. Hold on a minute, I'll find out when the first one was.
It was
2009. And everyone said the same thing, that it's cool, it looks great and all this, and the 3D was fun, but there's nothing in it. Yeah, there's no substance to it.
Yeah, but this, okay, I think now that we have I know, is it the third or the fourth film? I have no fucking idea. Sorry for swearing so loud on your show. It's also based on the memory of the success of the first film. This was a time when film still had a cultural impact. And I remember to some extent that one of the identitarians, you know, in Vienna, when they were founded in 2012 or so, one of the first stickers they had was a blue creature from that film, and the film would be interpreted as a identitarian film. You know, these blue creatures are, you know, defending, you know, their way of life and culture against human colonists. You know? So there was a sticker with one of those blue creatures on it and would say 100% identity, 0% racism. Yeah, that's very cringe. I admit that, but you could do that because this was a recognizable creature from a film.
I see what you mean. It made an impact.
You know, you conceive a message, you know, with that sticker, and you use a very popular film, which, you know, you could say it does have an identitarian theme, you know. A bit like sometimes you get films where, I think it started with Dances with Wolves, and then I have a film included in my book. It's called The Last Samurai, and it has Tom Cruise, and he's joining the, you know, traditional samurai in the 19th century who lead a revolt against the modernization of Japan. And this film shamelessly, you know, glorifies traditional ways of life and paints it as very heroic if you defend this, you know, to the last man, even if you are set up to fail, you know, you die, you know, defending what is dear to you. And these films get away with it because you have romanticized foreign cultures. You know? You have, let's say, Japanese samurai, or you have Indians, or in this case, you have just some anthropomorphic creatures in space, you see.
Mm. Yes, yes. And that's what James Cameron was doing with Avatar. The humans are pretty much crap. And the blue people are innocent and capable, honorable, etc. But I think the point that you were working towards is that while the first Avatar film made an impact on the culture, the second and third have just sunk without trace, really. I mean, they've made a huge... That's the weird thing. They have made a huge amount of money at the box office. Loads of people have gone to see them. But no one talks about them. And this is a point that I've made a lot in the last few years. I can remember the mid and late 90s. I used to buy Empire magazine every month and Premiere magazine every month. I was really into cinema. And there was another one, film, I can't remember. And every year I watched the Oscars. I even recorded it onto VHS, at least one year. It was all important. It mattered. You could say it was kind of lightweight, but it was... It was relevant to life, to certainly to the culture, and I was really into it. That's all stopped. I mean, and part of this might be just the disgracing of Hollywood as an institution, but I'm not sure. I think a large part of it, the biggest reason for this, is that the internet just has splintered culture into 1,000 pieces. I mean, and so everyone can actually go to see the same film, but then somehow there's no, I don't know, are they all watching a different film when they watch this Avatar 3, or is there just no way for them to, because then they go straight back to all their small niche subcultures after watching it. I don't know, but for whatever reason, mainstream cinema, just isn't as relevant as it used to be. It's a kind of joke. It's like something people do just to pass some time.
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm getting at. And I think this is a rather interesting phenomenon, which I only became very conscious about in the last 2 or 3 years or so. I mean, it all started when I realized that I knew who Taylor Swift was, but I had never heard a song by her. I didn't know what music she makes, you see. And so I check out songs on YouTube, and I get it, didn't like it much, I must say. I mean, but I see that there is a gigantic audience for this. And when I remembered the way pop culture used to be, is that whether you liked it or not, you could not escape it. Everybody knew that song. It was playing on the radio or TV. It was a common experience people shared. And now, because the consumption is all through internet streaming, and everybody can go into his own bubble, and I mean, it could be a bigger or a smaller bubble. It could be a bubble of your own where the algorithms find out what you like, and then they set up playlists for you. But still, everybody can go into these bubbles, and not share it with others. I mean, you could also go and say, okay, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in the 1980s. I'm only going to listen to 1980s stuff. And all is available now. You know? I mean, 10 years ago, we say, wow, this must be a paradise. You just, can listen to music like you turn on a tap of water and everything is there. You know, you can find almost everything, every album. You discover a certain band and then you discover every album, every song of theirs. So much is on YouTube, and even if it's very obscure stuff. So everything is available. And this is a big banquet you can join in. And of course, I mean, I use it as well. It's nice, it's good, but the perception of what you get is different, because things a bit lose their value if they are so easily available, or people do not take, more time to listen to it. Back then, when you had an album, you bought an album. I mean, there are still albums around, but the concept of an album has become sort of, you see, absurd, or kind of pointless. Not absurd, not, but let's say a bit pointless in a way. So, but back then you would value this thing more. You would have buy this album and then you would listen to it and know every song by heart. And so, of course, there are still people who can do that, you see. They can value what they listen to, but the majority of people, I don't know, they just swim in this huge ocean of stuff, and are probably not even listening or watching closely enough anymore. And certainly it doesn't create a culture, a common culture. It's just a huge, disfragmented pool of stuff where you can, pick what you like, you see. And I think this is what I mean by post-cultural, in a sense, that culture used to be a thing that unites people, that sort of creates an understanding, that creates certain images, certain values, And this is true even if you assume there are subcultures, because the subcultures, they are in relation to the mainstream culture. You see, they get their tension out of opposing mainstream culture, but they lose this tension if this mainstream culture is just one like another. You see, in a way, all these things become equal, sort of.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think it might be. I can think there are two processes going on at once here. On the one hand, media is now abundant in the sense that you can watch anything you want at any time of the day or night. Massive, massive number of options. And like even TV, for those people who still have a TV, it's got 100 channels, where it used to have like 3 or 4 when we were kids. So it's abundant. But at the same time, I believe there are fewer films being made now, far fewer films being made now. By like each studio used to make about, I think it used to release about 15 films a month back in the 90s. Whereas now things are like the production standards are so high that it takes ages to make anything. I was saying on my AMA last night that this absolute fucking garbage shitfest Alien Earth, which I didn't even tell you about because it would take so long to describe how awful it is. they've lost the studio that they had in, I think it's in Thailand. So now they're going to have to rebuild all the sets to make a second season. And it's going to take about 2 or 3 years before they get the next season broadcast. Well, and there were only 8 episodes in the first place. Star Trek and whatever, that used to be like 26 episodes in a season. Whereas now it's 8. It's the same with all of these programs. They take so long to make that you hardly, and they cost so much to make that you hardly make any of it. So on the one hand, you've got this massive abundance, but at the same time, you've got this scarcity. I don't know if this is relevant. It just occurred to me while you were speaking.
Yeah, was it from Alien, this Alien series, where you showed me a clip where the sea wasn't moving in the background?
Yeah. this is so bizarre. It's something I didn't mention when I was raving about it last night. Episode 7, it takes a dive. It goes really, it's terrible already. But in episode 7, things just seem to fall apart. And one of the symptoms of that is the guy is standing by the sea, but the sea isn't moving. It's perfectly, it's frozen. And this happens in multiple shots, one after another. So obviously, they've obviously green-screened him in front of a CGI landscape, but they've forgotten to animate the sea water.
But are you sure? Maybe it's some weird alien seed that doesn't move and it's intentional.
No. Because fucking no, definitely not. It's set on Earth, hence the title. So you can never forget that it's on Earth.
And all right.
and then occasionally they'll cut to a shot where it's obviously filmed at the real place, and it's. And the seawater's moving. But this was a symptom of a sense of that they just had given up. They just didn't give a shit by the time they got to episode 7. And then you see the same thing in episode 8 as well, by the way. So amazing stuff. Anyone who's watched it, you might not have noticed this. It was I noticed someone pointed it out in one of a YouTube comment, and I went back and watched it, and I couldn't believe it. The only way this could have happened is if the entire thing is CGI, except for the actors. Because if it were, because it was a moving shot, so and still shots as well. So it wasn't just that they'd taken a photo of the real place. Because of the moving shot, that must be CGI. But as I say, they forgot to press the animate button on the rain on the seawater, so quite astounding. But yeah, that was a tangent about Alien Earth, and I don't want to get, because you haven't watched it, you know, wisely.
No,
the thing is, it's something you would only watch it just to see how fucking terrible modern writing is. That's the only reason to watch it, and it really is a lesson. I mean, it's a brutal lesson in how bad the writing is nowadays.
I think this is the crucial issue. I mean, the thing is, I am not a series guy. I know people who watch a lot of series. I mean, series have taken over. Cinema feature films are sort of dead, as you said. Nobody cares about the Oscars anymore. It's not relevant, right? So people are watching tons of series, they go endless, and I guess some of them may be good, but you know, the impression I get when I look into it, as you said, the problem is about the scripts, the script writing. There are so many, there's this abundance of technology right now, there's so many things you can do, you know. But the script writers have forgotten how films work. And this is why, I mean, this is a thing we certainly agree, because I know you love these old BBC TV dramas, you know, which are made with little money and little production values and all this. But they got actors, yeah. They got stories. These are the things that matter so much more, you see. And
absolutely.
This is this love.
I mean, the epitome. The epitome of this is Upstairs, Downstairs, not BBC. It was just all British TV in those days. So most of the series that I like were actually not made by the BBC. They were made by ITV.
I get it.
It's something that to say, because everyone always says BBC and they get that wrong. But anyway, the point is, the epitome of it was Upstairs, Downstairs. And the writers of that explicitly said, using the techniques of the theatre, the stage, we don't need a huge budget. We can just have a sound effect, or we can just allude to something. We don't need to actually show it. Because that, after all, is how people experience most things. They don't see the event taking place. Somebody else tells them about it. So it was, and it's absolutely true. And what he said was, it shouldn't be about spectacle. What all drama is actually about is people, is human stories. And that was the thinking that dictated how they made it, and I couldn't believe it. I knew that they made each episode in one day, but I discovered recently that they actually made each episode in 4 hours, that they filmed it in 4 hours, a 50 minute piece of TV.
So incredible. This is incredible.
Incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was 2 weeks of preparation, or 10 days of preparation, and then 4 hours of actually filming. I mean, that is astounding. And as for the budget, I've no idea, but it would be just tiny, tiny, tiny compared to that fucking garbage of Alien Earth. God, I get so fucking angry thinking about that.
I love it when you get angry, you know. Your hate is like love to me. You know, this is the
just mention Alien Earth, and it will happen every fucking time. I guarantee.
I mean, it's also nice you mention Upstairs, Downstairs. I told you it was shown also on Austrian TV, and I saw it age 12 or so. So it's really long time ago, and you wouldn't think it may not be appropriate for a 12-year-old, but I loved it. You know, I loved it. I can't remember. I don't think there was an episode every day, but at least every week or so. But I never missed an episode, and I was fascinated by this British people. You know, there was this class thing. You had it was in the title, so you see, you had the aristocratic family, and you had the servants, you know, and they were on different levels. But the thing that got you most were the characters. You know, you like the butler. You like, wasn't her name Rose? She was the one servant. Yeah, I mean, she was my favorite. Yeah, she was my favorite character. You know, she and the butler, they were my favorite characters. I wanted to see what was going on with them.
Butler Hudson is wonderful.
Hudson.
And he was played by
Hudson.
Hudson. Yeah. Yeah, he was played by a Scottish actor called Gordon Jackson. And he's just a wonderful character. Great stuff. And this is it. That you actually care about the working class characters just as much as the upper class characters, if not more. They tend to have quite interesting lives and struggles and so forth. It's not. The class system is clearly there, very very rigid, but it's not dehumanizing. But yeah, the crucial point of all this is that they were able to make this. And it's stuff that people are still watching and enjoying 50 years later, half a century later. And it was made in 4 hours. I find that astonishing.
Absolutely.
I tend to think this might be a solution to the current malaise. We shouldn't be impressed by special effects in the way that we are. And I think because special effects are now sort of effortless in a way, especially with AI, I like to think that people will stop being impressed by them and they'll start demanding human stories again, actual drama. Because, you know, when T2 came out, the morphing and the T-1000 was amazing. It was impressive. It was, I can understand. I was only, 8 years old.
It still does look good. It holds up well. Yeah. You know, it does look good.
And I can understand people think, you know, getting excited by getting a thrill from it. It's the same thing with the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. I'm not blind to this. Of course, it's spectacular and amazing and all that. But 30 years on, this stuff is now pretty much effortless compared to back then. It's not the achievement that it was. And it's not the rarity that it was. It's not the novelty that it was. So I like to think that people will stop settling for that and actually start demanding well-written drama again. Because as I say, Upstairs Downstairs was doing it 20 years before Jurassic Park with an absolutely minuscule budget. And you can still enjoy it now 50 years later. I think that's incredible.
Mm. The thing is that sensations, people get used to it very quickly. So today, I mean, compared to 100 or 200 or 300 years ago, we live in an age of incredible miracles, but they seem to be completely ordinary to us. They bore us. We don't think of them as something special. So this happens very quickly that you get, you know, bored by spectacle, or it doesn't impress you that much anymore. I mean, people are just like that, you know. But what people don't get tired of, I think, is the human drama, the personalities, the clash of, you know, this is all what, you know, Shakespeare is made of, and Upstairs Downstairs is made of. You see,
absolutely. There's one episode of Upstairs Downstairs that is about the rivalry between two nannies looking after a baby, and one of the women is like old in her 60s and the other's in her 20s, and it's 50 minutes about nothing but that, and it's great. It's really engrossing and engaging. It's actually very enjoyable to watch. It would never happen now. There would never be a drama like that nowadays. I've got to say, people in the Rumble chat are desperate to see us. So shall we put the cameras back on and see how it goes? It might work better.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
I'm back on.
Okay.
You want to see us, people? Here we are in our glory. But I'm afraid my transmission is not as good.
Yeah, but the audio sounds good.
I have a shitty camera here.
Mm. Nah, don't worry about it. The audio is what matters.
Okay. Now you have to put me back into line. What were we talking about? Right, the human drama. Yeah, I mean, okay. Let me think. A lot of things to say here. Yeah, I mean, for example, Ellen Kositzer, from Secession, she did the proofreading of my book. She was going through it, and because, you know, the process of bookmaking in our little publishing houses, we have to do everything ourselves. You know, we have to read the corrections, and you find mistakes in it. And she told me that the chapter she dislikes or doesn't like as much as the others is the chapter about the films about myth and dystopias. And she said, not because it's not as good as the others, but because these are not the kind of movies she would like to see. And these are all the movies that have, to a certain extent, special effects, right? And then you have something interesting. You go back into, let's say, 1923, and you have Fritz Lang directing Die Nibelungen. And it's the silent movie era. And listen, Wolfie, I would really like to go back to the off-screen talk. Can we do that?
Oh, right. Okay. All right, I'll switch my camera off then. I think it's okay, distracting.
Okay, you have seen me, guys. Here I am. It's me. So, okay, I go back.
Sorry, right. Everyone. I can talk. I have to do what he wants.
That's good. Always do what I want.
Yes.
No, it distracts me from talking a bit, you know. Right. So this is the silent movie era. I was always fascinated by it because this is the time when cinema, as you know, was invented, and you had these fanatical pioneers who would do things that you would do for the first time. It seemed back then, it seemed like you had discovered a new miraculous art based on a technology, and you could make visions come true. You could make people see things they would never have imagined. And so there's an essay by Fritz Lang from that time, and he writes about this magic of cinema, the power of cinema to, you know, you can revive old myth. In that case, the Nibelungen, the famous German legend or myth, and not only you can make it be seen, you know, you can make it real, you can make real people move. And in that film, they had some special effects that were considered spectacular back then. For example, they have an animated dragon. So they have Siegfried slay the dragon, and it was a creature built up, a mechanical creature, and inside there were like 20 people moving it. And it could blow smoke from the nostrils, and it could bleed, and it could die. And then you have this fight against the dragon, and of course the dragon is now rather cute, you know, because it's not as impressive as it used to be. It's you can see this is a sort of mechanical or like a puppet, in fact, you know.
I find that stuff fun though. I enjoy that it's not real, you know. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. This is where I was getting it. Now the most part, there are also some photographic effects in the film. So they get to Iceland and they have to fight the Brunhilde the Valkyrie in a competition, so she can get married by King Gunther, and they have this light effects to create this mystical, you know, icy place. And this still looks very nice, I have to say. Yeah. And some special effects didn't hold up as well, others more. And the story is now a rather grim story, you know. It ends in a huge massacre, and it's, you know, Teutonic and tragical and doesn't end happy for anyone, you see. So the dragon is some kind of fun thing in that story. But when you look at the film today, you see it's not the technical things that make these creatures appear that impress people the most, but it's other things, you know. It's the conflict between the characters, it's the style, you know, the incredible optical style of the film, where every frame is composed like an architecture, like an ornament, and so. And then you switch forward, also another German film, 60 years later, you have that film, The Neverending Story. And I have included this in my book as well. And now this film, I saw it as a kid when it was released in cinema, and was one of the most, you know, exciting experiences of my childhood to see this film on screen. And only a few years later, I saw it on TV, and it wasn't that great anymore. I mean, it was a bit cringe. And now rewatching it again, I realized that this is all pre-CGI. I mean, all the creatures are puppets. Everything is handmade. And the same is true for Excalibur, John Borman, which is more like a fantasy film for grown-ups. And you have this great visual optics. For example, the most important thing in Excalibur is the shining armor of the knights. And there are so many variations of this. And some pictures, there's some scenes, they look like pre-Raphaelite paintings, lots of details and these wonderful colors and all that. And the thing is also in that film, everything is made in the camera, with the camera. You have real smoke, you have real fire, you have real sets, you have photographic tricks. I consistently pointed that out in the book, if a film was made like that. And if you have this era, let's say 2000s, when CGI, there were lots of trashy CGI fantasy movies being made. They look really bad today. They look awful. So the stop motion films of earlier days look much better now than the CGI films of the 2000s, you see. So this is kind of stuff that easily fails to impress you. You get used to it, and then you look up at films that are very different. Like I had this Pasolini film Medea, and it has the Greek myth. And I remember also seeing it as a teenager on TV. You have a scene of a human sacrifice, which is a sort of archaic ritual reenactment taken, you know, straight from the Golden Bough or so. And this was basically made, and they had these costumes, of course, they had these settings. Then at one point, what's it called in English? The Kentau, which is the half man, half horse creature, appears from Greek mythology, a centaur, yeah. And it's basically a guy in a wooden horse. It doesn't even move, you know, but it's consciously, you see, because the point is not the effect, right? So in these films, you know, I'm not much of a special effects guy myself. I mean, I included, of course, Lord of the Rings. I mean, this is certainly one of the greatest films made in this genre, in this area. But I have to say, it's not my kind of a film, even if I enjoyed it much, right? And you can see that it was still shot on film. It does use computer-generated effects, but it also has real landscapes in New Zealand. And above all, it has a good story. And it's clear, it's completely free from any shit that came after it, you know, the whole diversity stuff, you know, that ruined so many films. So it's in a way a miracle this film even exists, you see.
I'm actually more interested in seeing that there was an old version of it, an old adaptation that was done with animation, I think in the late 70s.
Ralph Bakshi was written by Ralph Bakshi. Or whatever his name is pronounced, 1978 right. Or so. Yeah, it's an animated version.
Mm. Yeah, and I'm more interested in seeing that because I'm sure that I forgot his name, Peter Jackson. I'm sure it's tremendous. I don't doubt it for a second.
But you haven't seen it.
No, I haven't seen it. I haven't read the books either. But I'm sure that something lo-fi would appeal to me more, something that forced you to use your imagination and was evocative. I think that would be more exciting for me. But, you know, hopefully by the time I die, I will have watched these films. I mean, I don't want to, I'm not against seeing them. It's just that, that's a whole other thing. I just wanted to make the point that the more expressionistic thing of the animation, I think that would be more exciting for me. But the other thing about that trilogy is that you've got to compare it with the Hobbit trilogy made 10 years later, which was shot digitally. You've got a big thing about digital versus film. And I think a lot of people aren't quite aware of this. Film was actually like literally film. It was celluloid, and the image would be, it was a chemical process with light, and the film would have to be developed, and it would have grain, and the film would react to light in a certain way and to darkness in a certain way. And then all of that was basically replaced with digital, which works with a what's called a CMOS sensor. I don't know what that stands for. I did at one point. And it all just becomes digital bits, data, immediately. And that's how it's stored. So it's a complete, it's an entirely different technology. It works through a lens, through a camera lens, but that's pretty much the only similarity. And so again, the CMOS sensor reacts to light in very different ways from film, and it can handle a lot more darkness actually than film can. It's much like, remember Kubrick with the Carl Zeiss lenses for Barry Lyndon. Modern digital cameras would be able to handle that low light very easily. It's in some ways, there's no question that it opens up possibilities. The problem is that the result doesn't look very good. It's bland. Yeah. It's sterile.
Yeah. 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 Well, you know how to get me started. this is a thing I take a lot of issue with. Yeah, absolutely. You put it very well. I mean, the fascinating thing about film is it's the light and the darkness is caught by the chemicals on this celluloid, and it's being developed. I mean, then it's projected through light. You need light again so you can see the film, because you have the stripe of celluloid and you have to put a light through it and then project it on. So you have two stages where actual light is very important, and you can see the light that is caught on film through the lens. You can see it projected again. So there is something here from reality, from the thing that matters a lot to us, which is light. You know, and darkness is absence of light. And you used to see films in darkness. There's a book I haven't read yet, but I got a copy because I read it's interesting. It's called In Broad Daylight, and it's a film about the way watching movies has changed if you watch them on digital screens. Mostly, right? Which I do now as well. You know, sometimes I go to cinema, but I'm not different. And but the digital screens allow you to watch films also when it's not completely dark. You know, you can watch them. I mean, people even do.
The thing is, I saw The Shining in 2010. And it was a digital projection, and I've got to say, I didn't like it. I really didn't like it. It felt bland and sterile again.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is, I perceived this immediately. You know, I see it immediately. You show me the projection. I can even analyze. You know, maybe sometimes I'm wrong, but even digital projections of actual films look more bland. They don't have this look anymore. So in the 2007, I guess, is a crucial year. So this is when the smartphone or the iPhone was introduced, and also digitalization of shooting films. I mean, it started before, and then it went on, and it has almost completely replaced 35mm film. And this is the one thing destroyed collective pop culture. The other thing destroyed the magic for films for me. I'm not saying, I mean, you still can do a lot of creative things with digital video, right? You can tell stories, you can have good acting, you can have anything, but the specific magic of the optics of films is not quite there for me anymore. I stopped enjoying them, right? Even more and more. And for me, I realized there was also for me a mystic about it, about the light being projected. I mean, you could also even see it if you had VHS copies of films, or maybe you see it on a it's better to see this film on a laptop screen than have it projected digitally, I think. You still can see more of the film optics. And I remember just a few months ago, I for some mood and reason, I wanted to see a old Steve Martin comedy with Steve Martin and John Candy, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. You know, it brought tears to my eyes. You know, I mean, it's yeah. just a. It's not a deep film. It's fun, but it looked so good. You know, it had this cozy, wonderful optics and look, and I miss it so much. Huh? And I can tell you, another example that comes to my mind is that The Leopard, you know, by Visconti, and this is a film you can rarely see it on a big screen. It's a huge epic from the 1860s in Italy when the National Revolution started, and it's about this aristocrat who has to adapt to modern times, and it's very lavish, a very lavish production in color and widescreen, and it all ends with a huge ball, which is a sort of farewell, you know, or the final, you know, big ball before the aristocracy goes down in the new age. And I noticed that, I think it was a part of the technology, the lighting would be very broad, you know. It wouldn't look like, my thought was, this doesn't look like it, how it would have looked like in the 1860s if you had a huge ballroom and you would light it. Huh? And it's sort of I had to get used to it a bit, you know. But then you get lost in the colors and everything, and it just sweeps you away. You know, it's a magnificent sequence, one of the most famous sequences in film history. It lasts about 40 minutes, this whole ball sequence. And so then 15 years later, you have this thing with Kubrick. You mentioned it, shooting Barry Lyndon. And then they made a TV series remake of The Leopard. Now, and what I see, it seems to be a decent film, and they use a lot of these effects with the candles and the torches and the kind of lights that would be used in the 1860s. I couldn't help it. I didn't like it. And nothing looks like Barry Lyndon. Nothing looks like Barry Lyndon. I'm sorry. No, even though if you have now more ability to shoot with candlelight, it just doesn't look like it. I don't know if it's just me, but the magic isn't there.
Was that recent? Yeah. The Leopard.
Yeah. Just last year, very recent. And I saw shots on it.
Now. Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, I thought it looked so generic, you know. It just looked like a Netflix movie, you know. There was a lavish production values, costumes, everything, you know. But I couldn't help it. It didn't look like something original or something. No, compared soulful. To the, yeah, soulful, yeah. This is also a thing. I mean, it's hard to convey because certainly also people have different conceptions of what is soulful. And sometimes I realize people are taken in by films I find completely soulless, but some people see in it things I do not see, you see. And this is also one of the issues when you debate art like that. On one hand, you are stuck in very subjective perceptions and tastes, you know? But on the other hand, if you say that this is all just subjective, you know, this is all your taste and everybody has a different taste, it becomes boring. It becomes nihilistic in a way.
Yes, but that's the point that you made in your essay. That's a point that you made in your essay, your most recent Substack essay. That you can't have this total democracy thing where everyone, it's all just subjective and everyone likes what they like, and there's no right or wrong, because that's, as you say, boring. It doesn't point to anything.
Wait, are you there?
Yes. I'm saying that you made that point on Substack about this total democracy thing.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I think about this a lot in my life, you see. But in the end, these, of course, the value judgments in history, they change. This is true, right? And often, I mean, you have a guy like Bach. Probably he was more appreciated in the 19th century than he was in his own time, or Vincent van Gogh or whoever. No? So there are also changing perceptions and values, judgments, and I can see that this is in a flow. Yeah, but how can you escape the trap of saying this is all subjective taste? I mean, in the end, this is made by people. You know, it's a thing of the people who either create, you know, or who understand and digest creation. And within these people, there's a flow, you know, of perceptions, and also because you want to have different things from a music or a film or so. And this is something that I think people who understand get it, you know, and people who don't get it never will. They get angry at you if you make value judgments, you know. I mean, you always say, yes, I know, these hierarchical judgments in art, they are subjective, and sometimes you can say that, yes, I like this film, but it's not the greatest film. Or you can see a film and say, I admit this is a great film, but I don't really like it, you see. And so you get into a sphere that is very limited. It's a limited hangout to people who know, and know, but not everybody can join it. You understand what I mean? I get very annoyed by people who want to flatten this discussion all the time. I mean, I need to have people get passionate about one thing or another. It's not about being right about it, you see, because it's hard to decide who's the judge. There is no judge, you know? But if you give up judgment, if you stop being passionate about what is good and what isn't, then the tension goes away. It starts to get boring, you know. This is, I think,
Well, this is why we had film critics, as much as any other reason. This was one of the benefits of having film critics, because it provided a furniture for the discussion about the film to take place in. If we have total democracy, where everyone just likes whatever they want, and there's no elite opinion, let's say, then it just goes nowhere. This is a weird thing. I was talking about this the other day on, I think, in the AMA. I said that the trouble with online, the online world, and especially with AI filmmaking and whatever, is that there's not going to be a system to handle the film after it has been made, to distribute it, to recommend it, to discuss it. At least not a system that everyone else will know about and hear. They won't hear those judgments. It'll just be people discussing it on a website somewhere, but it won't be on the TV. It won't be that critic's reaction to the film. So I don't know what, I don't think there's any solution to this yet. Maybe there'll never be a solution to it. Maybe we'll, and the thing is, people will say this, that film critics were often, they often talked rubbish. You know, they were often wrong. They often misunderstood a film, or they had a shit opinion about it or whatever, or they just didn't like that director, so they weren't even being fair on the film. That's all true, but at the same time, it's also true that without the critics, there's no real discussion about the film. And then ordinary people, the general public, just they're just lost at sea. They've got no idea what to think.
In order to be a good critic, you need to know a lot of things, you need to have a judgment, you need to compare. And even if you are wrong, let's say what is wrong, but sometimes you see that films got a judgment that seems curious years later, you see. But sometimes you find there was a point in it, you know. Sometimes films become classics, they become sort of mortified, and nobody questions them anymore. But then you read contemporary reviews and you see people saying critical things about it that didn't occur to you. So you need standards, right? And I think this is all what the process of culture is about, that people have standards and they apply to them, and they may not see what the artist was doing here. They may be ignorant to it. They may be in that sense wrong, you see, that they underestimated or overestimated. But this is, I'd say, culture. You know, if you have real culture, this is a process, you know, it's not something static. It means people care about what they see, you see? And then it's alive. And if this stops, you know, then it also loses the tension. It stops being alive. And, yeah, this is where I'm getting it, you see? So I also tried to put my judgments of my films, you know, I tried to lay them out in a convincing way, you know? I want people to understand what I am seeing here and why I am seeing it. Yeah, the same way that I like to read a review that is enlightening, that makes me see more things in a film or so. And this is, yeah, the process of culture, to make you perceive more, to make you think more. I mean, I like films that make me think. Yeah, of course, I know I like to be entertained. You know, I like the joy of it, but I have a joy in thinking, you know, about what I see here. And in order to do that, you can learn a lot from people who have experience, who have a different view. So this is what it's about for me. You know, there's a constant competition or a constant conflict or a constant questioning and praising and so. And people still do that, you know, but it gets, how should I put it, you know, it becomes so fragmented. People will do it in their niche or in their bubble, right? And at one point it's just a thing for them, you know, or for the little bubbles or niches, you know, it ceases to be a general cultural movement, you know, or a thing that moves.
Yeah. I mean, just like the films don't enter the general culture and have a cultural impact, neither do the criticisms of the film. So the Guardian film review will just... It's read by Guardian readers, maybe. Maybe not even by them. And it definitely won't have a wider impact.
This is a reason why I do have a sort of respect for, you know, my not really adversary, but the guy I picked as a sort of imaginary adversary, Wolfgang Schmidt, because he's holding on to a very old school conception of what a film critic should do, you know, or is about to do. And he's serving a certain leftist audience who still also has this kind of standards and values. But in some way, it becomes more and more anachronistic. And I see him reviewing all these pointless, shitty, stupid films. But he, you know, he's sort of brave, you know, doing it still, you know, as if, you know, he's acting as if this kind of culture would still be there, as if this kind of critics would still matter. Because there were times when film critics were also sort of names of their own. They were stars of their own, you know, in America, people like Pauline Kael, you know, they could make or unmake a film. They had power, you know, they were names, and sometimes you can still read their reviews years later, you know, and they shed an interesting light on the films. Yeah? But this power of film critics has ceased, and at the same time, the heroic figure of the film director, who's an auteur, you know, an author. This was it started in the 1950s and 60s when you, and was done through film critics, yeah, that you would perceive our film directors more like authors and personalities. And then you had this golden age of the, you know, art house film, especially in Europe. And you had these heroic figures like, you know, Bergman and Antonioni and Fellini and Buñuel. And you would talk about them. And today you have a few people, very, very few people left. Those who are left are old. Scorsese, right? I mean, he's an old man now. Probably he still does good films. David Lynch, for me, was one of the last ones who went. And then you have people like Christopher Nolan, who I think are rather overrated, and a bunch of others. And sometimes I see what they do, but it just doesn't convince me. They don't have this, you know, they don't have this status, you know, of what the old authors of cinemas used to have. You see, and you, it's not like this, wow. I wonder.
This makes me wonder where it's all going to go. I saw a thing from Christopher Nolan the other day. He was praising some stupid film. I can't remember what it was. And it was almost like he's just saying this to get into the news. He's just saying this to keep himself relevant. I don't know. But the point is that he's obviously a huge film director today. Very famous, very successful, loads of well-regarded films. But I think it's probably only people like you and me who even know his name. He's not famous like Scorsese was famous or Spielberg was famous.
Or Lynch, Kubrick. Lynch for that matter. Especially in the 90s when Twin Peaks was a big hit, you know. Twin Peaks was a huge hit, you know. I mean,
film directors. Now, I mean, I can't even. I know Christopher Nolan, Paul Anderson, but I can hardly name any directors today. It's just occurred to me now. I can't reel off a list of film directors who are working today.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time I remember when I got interested in cinema, when film directors were like gods to me, you know, and it was so curious to read interviews with them and to wait for their new upcoming film. And so it just has ceased to be, absolutely. And
I think there's going to have to be some sort of solution to this. And it might be that film, cinema, Hollywood, is dead. It's over. It's heading for the end now. I think that is true. But all of these people are still going to make films, and people are still going to make dramas in one kind or another, even if it's not 90 minutes long. I think filmed dramas will still be made. And there's going to have to be some system for handling them, for distributing them, making them, you know, getting them to the public, recommending them to the public, and for discussing them. And right now I don't think there is. What you have is these people on YouTube, I won't name names, but there are big film review channels, and I guess that's the equivalent of Roger Ebert from Pauline Kael from back in the day, but they're much lower brow. I mean, they are, and also much more biased, frankly. I mean, there are people who are right wing, like right wing film reviewers, and they've got these big channels on YouTube. And I'll watch, and they'll talk about TV and stuff. And I'm certain that they're so biased that they're just saying what their audiences expect them to say about this film or that TV show. Where they'll write it off and they'll just say it's complete crap, it's garbage, don't bother watching it. And I'm sure that it's the same on the left as well. And I guess that the point is, this is the democratization that's happened. So there's a much lower quality of conversation about the films. I mean, this is just bad. It's a crap situation. And I think eventually there's going to have to be some solution to it. Because I don't think that a culture can really continue like this for very long, or at least I don't think there's ever been a culture like this before now, because there's never been the internet before now.
Yeah, I agree what you say. I mean, I see on sometimes you see a good film analysis on YouTube, and then you click on them, and then the algorithm sends you more of that stuff. And I find YouTube increasingly annoying because you have all these very stupid screening at you clickbaity titles and thumbnails, and it's becoming increasingly idiotic. Yeah. And even then, when I get offered film reviews, I see that people are mostly talking about old films. I mean, by old films, I mean, let's say it stops in the 2010s or so, you know, and I think few films today will be watched in 10 or 20 years and still be loved, but maybe no film will be like that. I couldn't say. Yeah. This is also stuff for bubbles. This is also stuff for algorithms. It doesn't have a real relevance. And I told you, this is a reason why I sort of like this guy, Wolfgang Schmidt. I sort of have respect for what he's heroically doing, anachronistically doing. I mean, it's something I'm even anachronistically doing in a way. And, I see this often. I tell you a difference from a different kind of art. It's just something that had been on my mind in the last days. But it goes into a similar direction. So I always like to go. The thing is, I liked to be within a culture, you know, back then in the 90s when I was a cinephile, and then you would read the papers with the good reviews, and you would go, let's say, in Austria and Vienna Film Museum, which is the Cinematheque of Vienna, or other, you had certain cinemas that would show old films or art house films, and you would have programs to read, and you would have books published, and so you felt, okay, there's a culture going on, and you're sort of participating in it by going to these screenings, you know, by going to these speeches or lectures, by, you know, when sometimes a director would be at Film Museum and you would go there and listen to him. So I liked the feeling of participating in a culture, even though, of course, I was always a bit in the subcultural niche, you see. I was always always to a certain extent in opposition to the cultural realm, but not in total opposition. You know? I didn't think this is something to be totally opposed, but I felt there's something I also can participate, something that is also true for me, even though I have criticisms, you know, even if I want to see different things also. Yeah? But there wasn't a complete disconnection between me and the culture that was prevailing. And this is something I liked and enjoyed. And I also always like to go to see art exhibitions. In Vienna, we have great art exhibitions still today. They are well chosen, and you have these certain themes, and then you get these paintings. You see all these paintings for a few weeks, have a chance to see them in real. And I always liked that. But I got increasingly alienated from culture around me, especially by the ideology that took hold of these people who run it, who run the Kulturbetrieb, we say in German, who run the cultural organization, you know, who run the galleries, who run the museums, who run the theaters, and so they got increasingly into a more ideological and stupid line. I mean, there was always a left-wing bent here, but over the years it became more extreme and more annoying. And one of the signs that is absolutely unbearable for me, and this is something you English-speaking people are spared of, is the way they treat the masculine and feminine in grammar of words. You know, the generic masculine and feminine of words, you know, we have, I even don't know how to express it in English, but, you know, we have these genders of words like the French have, you know, what I'm talking about here.
Yes, yes.
We have male and female words, you know, and forms, you know, And increasingly, I see this ideology, and that the male generic form is the normal form for things, you see? And now somebody had this idea that this is a sign of patriarchal oppression, and you have to change in language, and you have to use also the female form when you say a word, you know? When you say, for example, students, you know, you would, in back in days, you would say students, the male generic form, and it would include male and female students. And then it would say, no, you have to specifically add the female form as well. But then they would continue and they would do funny things like, you know, write a letter in the middle of the word, a capital letter, you know? So you have both forms in one word. Or then you would continue to this thing they do today. They put this asterisk into the word. Is this the word?
For
this star?
For God's sake!
Yeah.
That's terrible. That must be so distracting every time, and it must feel strange every time.
So I have such a relief that you understand me, you know, because this is a never-ending pain for me to see this. It's a mutilation of the German language. And you read it, and it's like a barbed wire. I also compared to a barbed wire put into these words, and they become fragmented, and they become ugly. And then, I think I'm pretty good at English, you know, but I fail to... explain this now properly. I guess you understand. I hope the Anglophone audience knows what I'm talking about here, because we have this male and female forms of words. And then the words become mutilated, they become fragmented, and you put these asterisks in them, they look like a barbed wire. It's a barbed wire to keep the intelligent people outside and to offend them, you know, to hurt them. You know, for me, it hurts me, you know? And it increases my alienation. So, for example, this year I went back to Film Museum in Austria, which is an institution that has been there for 60 years or so. And this is the holy temple of cinephiles. And I spent so many nights there, especially when I was a student in Vienna. And they used to have these little programs with little descriptions of the film or essays by the films. They were written by a guy who recently died. His name was Harry Tomicek, and he was an excellent writer. And I loved reading this, you know. I mean, this was so well written, and it was perceptive and sometimes poetic. And now I open up the program, and it's mutilated with this asterisk, you know, and with this gender, you know, we call them the genderized forms of the words. And this signal, what do they signal to me? They signal to me utter stupidity, you know. They signal the triumph of ideology over what it's supposed to be, you know, culture and art, and it alienates me completely. I mean, this feeling I used to have, let's say 20 years ago, when I was participating in culture, while at the same time sort of being opposing it in some way, but still within the framework, today I feel like I'm separated from it through this ideological barbed wire that says keep all the intelligent people who care about the German language out, you know, or keep the people out who do not share this stupid super progressive ideology, because the asterisk signifies that you're also including trans people, for fuck's sake. I mean, it's so silly. It's terrible. So some days ago, I go with some friends to an art exhibition in Vienna, and it was a very interesting topic. It was called Occultism in the Art in the 1900s, you know, which is a time I find very interesting, especially in Vienna. And it was not only about occultism, it was about what they call in Germany Lebensreform, which is when you had all these kind of ideas how to, you know, oppose modernity or to get forms of modernity that, you know, sort of enhance the human being, you know, that they had these ideas like nudism, like vegetarianism, like spiritism. They had all kind of new philosophies. Wagner was a big thing. It wasn't just about the music. It was about the philosophy in it. Nietzsche was a thing and all this. So there was this huge impulse in the arts and in culture that there's a big change going on and we need to create something new. You know, we see that old things don't work anymore. We see technology rising. What are we going to do about it? You know, what are we going to do about the loss of religion and spirituality? And artists at that time were very much concerned with that. So many artists at that time, they perceived themselves as prophets, as visionaries, no, of a new kind of life, of a new kind of being, of a new kind of way to, you know, enhance.
And what being time a human was being. This? Yeah.
1900s, let's say 1900s. Right, okay. So the framework
it's funny,
of this exhibition
was. I actually wrote an essay this year where I talked about exactly the same time in London. And I said this, that yes, there were movements that were sort of left-wing and there were movements that were sort of right-wing, like the futurists, the vorticists in London. Mm. But they coexisted because they hadn't become ideological yet on either side. They still had to coexist with each other. And it's an interesting, because at that point, you could sort of drift between these and someone from one crowd could fraternize with people from another because you weren't alienated and you definitely weren't kept out in the way that they're doing now.
Right. You absolutely understand where I'm getting at. I mean, also, it's a very exciting time. Let's say the framework of this exhibition was 1890s to, let's say, 1920s or so, right? And this is a quite exciting time, not just in Germany, but generally in Europe. And at that time, it's really hard to say what ideas are left or right wing because there's a flux between them. There's something developing. Now, there are ideas that only later get into more ideology that, people become either communists or fascists in the 1920s and 30s. And they all come from this direction. But you see a pool of ideas and there's something going on and artists have this feeling they have a mission. The art should create something valuable for society, something to create a new consciousness, something to create a new way of living. And this is really interesting. So if you were, let's say, a Wagnerian, you were not just about the music. You had an idea of a vision, you know, of a new kind of culture in which art and religion would come together and where people would, and some of these ideas were strange and silly. Like some people said, oh no, you have to wear this kind of dresses that do not harm the body. You have to eat these kind of things. You have to build a new religion. You have to do this and that. So it was a very creative thing. I find this era fascinating. And also the art of this era is pretty fascinating. So I go there with a few friends and we really wanted to see this exhibition, all of us. And so we settled for a date when we all could meet and go there. And there was a guide for this exhibition. And it was this elderly, bespectacled woman and... it all started by her announcing that she's too clever to believe in all these kind of things like esoteric and anthroposophy and occultism, all these things that influenced the arts heavily at that time. Because there was this feeling of a need for a change, a need for spirituality, a need for new things. And so people would draw also on what we call today esoteric traditions, and they influence the arts, and she would announce that she doesn't believe in any of it and she's down to earth. And so the whole guide's tour was that she was so clever about everything, like we today know better. And from all this pool of ideas that were going on back then, she only picks out the progressive ones. You know, she says, yeah, the anthroposophists, they're kind of crazy, but at least they were for equality between men and women. You know, so she always picks out the things. You know, she always picks out the things that confer that align, you know, with today's progressive ideology. And everyone,
this is great. This is hilarious because she'll think that this is a symptom of how clever she is and how intelligent she is. And she doesn't believe in esoteric philosophy, but obviously she believes in trans rights. And obviously she believes that men and women are the same and that the races are all the same and so forth. Equality. Well, I really think that one day, probably quite soon, that is going to be regarded as just superstitious rubbish, which it is.
Yeah, of course. I mean, she was believing the rubbish of today and the rubbish of yesterday, which was not so rubbish, much of it, I guess. I mean, it was just a very simple, I mean, it was just very annoying, you know. So I dropped out of the guided tour and I watched these paintings on my own. And there was just one moment I couldn't hold back when there was a bust, is this the word, of Nietzsche? So it was a sculpture, a head of Nietzsche, you know.
Yeah.
And she goes on and says, right, this is Nietzsche, and this is he phrased the word God is dead in his book Das Spoke Zarathustra, and I just interfere and say, no, it wasn't in Das Spoke Zarathustra, it was in The Gay Science. It was a different book, right?
Very good.
And she goes on and says, well, do you want to continue with the tour? I said, no, I'm just saying. I mean, I couldn't help it. I just ejaculated, you know. But there was one point when she was... No, the thing is, it's one thing to write these gender-neutral forms of words in German, but what's even worse is pronouncing them. So she would say something like, so we next go into one of my favorite room. It's the Spiritistinnen, she said, you know. She makes a pause, you know, while saying the word. So the Spiritists, you know, like the guys who try to have a seance and invoking ghosts, which was very popular, you know, in the 1900s. You know, Conan Doyle, he was into it. And so it was a huge fashion back then. And the word would be Spiritisten, which is the masculine, generic, all-encompassing word. I mean, in proper grammar, it means both male and female. Then come the ideologists. They say, no, this is a patriarchal way of saying it. And so you have to include both forms. And she could say Spiritisten and Spiritistinnen. So she would include the male and female form, but she doesn't. This would be proper German. Yeah? But she doesn't. She says Spiritistinnen. She makes a little pause, and this is so fucking retarded. No?
How old was this artificial.
You know? She was in her 50s or so, I guess, and she was a complete soldier of this cultural, Kulturbetrieb. The paradigm and the system, you know, she's part of the system. She was clearly spouting this ideology all the time, and then she uses this way of using this masculine, and it's nobody speaks like this. It's artificial. This is not German language, you know. It's just a signal. She's just signaling. She's on with the ideology. She's following the ideology, and this is all, you know. And I thought, okay, when this guidance is done, I have to call her out for that. I have to confront her and politely, yes, and say, I don't think this is good that people start talking that way or pretend that it's okay or that it's German, because it's silly, you know, it's a pose, you see? It's a show, it's put on, you know, it's just signaling. And this kind of stuff make me feel very, very alienated from culture. Yeah? And not like it used to be when I started going seeing exhibitions and so. And now when I have to buy the catalog of that exhibition, I buy the English version because the German version is mutilated with these kind of ideologized forms. You can't read it anymore. And I can't help it. I react in it in a very sensitive way. It's ugly. It's stupid. It's dragging you down. It shows you this is occupied. No, it's occupied territory, occupied by these morons, right? And if you would ask most of the people, even those people who care for culture, they would say we don't need this kind of shit. No, I mean, it's just a tiny minority in the system that imposes it on everybody else. And most people are too inert, to oppose it, or they shut up and they just, it's the usual thing. This is the way all these kind of doctrines are imposed on us. It's usually just a few people who think this kind of stuff, but they manage to make it happen everywhere. And people go along with it like sheep. They're afraid to not consent. And I heard in this cultural system, you do not get hired if you don't use this genderized forms of words. You do not get hired if you don't use the proper words, they select you. They select you for that. And so gradually this whole cultural system gets filled with this terrible, stupid, ideological people. And I have to say the people that composed this exhibition were not doing a bad job. They did a good job, actually, I have to say, whoever did it. I mean, this was a the paintings were well chosen. It was interesting to see them, but then it gets marred by this ideology, this stupid, ugly ideology that is poured over it for no reason. Yeah. I mean,
I think this is perhaps when it's worst, when it's something that could so easily have been good, but then they choose to ruin it.
Very easily.
They choose to spoil it at the end.
They choose to spoil it. Yeah. This is exactly the point. That it would be so easy to make it intelligent, good looking, accessible, even if you don't share this ideology. But no, they have to do it. They have to signal they are a cultural institution. They are in the forefront of this progressive ideology, which is shallow. This is the thing. It's a very shallow ideology. So you have this very shallow woman. And she's making fun of ideologies of the 1900s, who in fact, some of them may seem dated or scurrilous or strange, but these were much more complex than the way she thinks. But she thinks she's above them. She's now enlightened and progressive, and today we know everything better than these people. And it was so annoying, this attitude, this midwittery attitude, this not respect, not enough respect, of people from the past, especially in this art thing here. So this was kind of really, really annoying. And but there's a second part to that story, and I'm trying to make a point here. So I have this experience. I'm in this cultural institution, and yes, I like to see the exhibition, but I have this barbed wire of ideological word. I mean, it literally looks like a barbed wire to me. You see, I use this word, this asterisk, which I including, which says, hey, we include trans people. We talk about artists from the 1900s, and we include trans people when we talk about them. There were no trans people among artists at that time, Or maybe they're there, I don't know, but I don't think they were so important that you need to include them. I don't have to explain this, do I? It's just stupid, right? So you are sort of alienated here from this official cultural system. And the system still does have some good things, It's not all bad, because I want to see these paintings. I'm glad this exhibition is there. But the feeling of cultural dysphoria is so huge. You see, some people have gender dysphoria. I have cultural dysphoria. Some people feel they were born in the wrong body. I feel I was born in the wrong culture. What should I do? I'm transcultural. I'm transcultural, right? Nobody cares about my suffering. It's awful.
I'm the same. I'm exactly the same. I mean, not many people know about upstairs, downstairs today. Most of them are petty. Just me.
No, I mean, there are thousands of things I could name here, but There's a second white pill part of the story here. So
these people are a joke, and go on.
Yeah, okay. So okay, I mean, me and my friends, we did enjoy the exhibition. We spent there 3 hours or so, and of course, yeah, this guide was pretty annoying. And then after we left the exhibition, we walk into the inner city of Vienna and we stumble by an art gallery. It's a small art gallery. And I'm not going into details, but the thing is, we watch a painting in the window and we got stuck on it. Yeah? And because I don't want to name the artist or so, but the thing is, we were so fascinated, and it was what we call, there's a school in Austria, which was in the 60s and 70s, pretty much a thing, was called fantastic realism, which is a sort of surrealism.
Oh, yes, I know about that. Yes, in English, we call it magical realism.
Right. It's that kind of direction. So it was a painting. It was using not oil colors, but tempera, which is, you have to mix them. It's a powder. The colors are powder. You have to mix them with egg yolk. So use them for icons as well. And the colors are very bright, very nice. And you could see this was a masterful painting of fantastic realism. It was a, you know, strange erotic scenes and mythological scenes and strange animals. And we go into this little, it was just like a shop, a little shop, you know. And we go in there, and I had never heard of that painter ever, but what we saw was incredible, you know, incredible. And we spent there, me and my friends, I don't know how much time, maybe 2 hours, and we watched everything and talked with the painter, and it was just an amazing discovery. And the guy, he was an older guy, and he was very happy that there were people who were so interesting in what he did. And everybody was happy. We were happy to have discovered this. He was happy. He found people to appreciate. And I never heard of that guy. And I can tell you, in the official art business, he would not be regarded well, because he paints things that are not abstract. He paints things that you can see it's out of fashion the way he paints, you know? But he told us he takes years for just one painting, right? And it was great. It was a man who really was serving his craft for decades, and this is what it was about. And so this is one thing that after I had a taste of the art culture organization and the people in it and the ideology that poisons it, we discover a true artist, a man really dedicated to what he does. And it was beautiful. So this was the white pill. And I thought, okay, there may be many like him that are not famous, that are not praised by this, you know, ideological art culture system. Because there will always be people like him, you know, people who need to create, otherwise they feel bad. This is what they were born for. You see, they have the talent. So, and I know quite a few people also in other arts, you know, like people who write poetry or who paint or who make music, and they just love what they do. They need to do what they do, and they do it regardless of the culture around us, or regardless of the organization of the culture, and regardless of the ideology that is around us. And for me, knowing that these people are there and hopefully will always be there, even if it's just, it doesn't matter if it's just very few of them, because art is only a thing for few people. Let's face it, you know, I mean, today we have this, you know, huge touristic organization of art galleries, and people run through the Louvre and then they go and see the you know, Mona Lisa by Leonardo, but nobody cares about the other Leonardo painting around the corner, which is much greater, I think, because they were told this is the great painting, you have to see it, right? And you get the masses, it's just a touristic thing, but in the end, it's just for a few people. This always has been, right? And I mean, I get really concerned. I mean, my book Against Smartphones was really much concerned about the problem how technology kills abilities of people. Because it does everything for you. You push a button, it makes a picture for you. You push a button, it composes a music for you. You push a button and it can do anything. It can think for you. You know, it can answer for you. It can write for you. I mean, what is left? These machines will be in the end more clever than the people who use it. Yeah. And the abilities of human beings will just deteriorate. And, I see a great danger in that. Yeah. And so this is why I get a huge white pill when I see there are still people who want to paint with their own hands, you know, who write, you know, with their hands, you know. It doesn't matter if they write on a computer, they compose words, you know, or they make music with actual instruments. As long as these people are there, I'm not entirely desperate. But I see a danger. I see this huge danger of this technology that puts everything into the machine. The machine is doing everything for you. And as we talked about the problem with the special effects in films, you easily get used to it. You easily get bored of it. You know? It's a marvel at one point, and it's fun, and it's a sort of, you know, technological magic, but you get used to it. You get numb to it, you see? And I think this is a great danger. You understand? And this is, I think, what my point was when I had this idea saying all great art today or all true art today is post-cultural, because there's no such thing as a culture anymore. What we thought is a culture, we still have a culture organization. We have people sort of interested in culture, right? But a museum is not just, a museum alone is not culture for me. You know, a museum is where things are, I mean, it's great that you have museums, I love museums, okay? But culture shouldn't be for museums only, it should be created continually, right? And so this was this one experience that I thought, okay, there are guys, people I have never heard of, and they create because they have to, and they do these beautiful things. And this gave me sort of hope. Now, and probably this is the future, now that this idea we have of culture is going to disintegrate, and there will only be fragments and fragments and fragments of bubbles and circles and people. They will do things, they will pick out from this huge pool they have. It's a huge pool. I mean, for them, it's probably great. They say, okay, I have a huge pool. I can search any painter I want on the internet. I can search any music I want on the internet, and then I can create something of my own. And these people will make something out of it. And I guess this is the way culture will be in the future, that it will be in this fragmented way, which is not collective anymore, which is not binding anymore, which will be just in thousands of niches. And this is probably not really a good thing, but as long as there's still something being created, it's not the worst thing that can happen. You see, the gist of it will be still there. You get what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it occurs to me that people will want to live alongside other people who share the same culture as they do. Obviously, this goes for multiculturalism, but I mean, even more precisely than that, the kind of thing that you're talking about. Yeah, it's nice to have your own culture. It's nice to have your own thing, your own micro culture that you're into, but we used to assume that you would live alongside other people who shared the same culture. So
right,
you would have certain paintings in your house. You would go to a cafe or a restaurant, and it would have similar paintings at that same time. And time comes into this as well. So you would have early 80s art late 80s art, etc. And so people felt that they were taking part in something. And I think that's actually an important feature of culture, that people feel that they are part of something.
Right.
So that's going to be a problem. If we have all these 1,000 microcultures in one country, and everyone meantime is taking, then what's the mainstream culture that people, because there has to be something that people are living in and working in and traveling in and walking in and eating in. So what's that going to be? And I wouldn't be surprised if you end up with people sort of setting up a town, like that town starts to have its own culture, its own microculture, and people who are part of that microculture move to that town. That could happen. Or it could be that this is just something that people do online. Like they take mm-hmm. part in the microculture purely online, and meantime they have to deal with some bland mainstream from day to day. I think that's the situation we have just now. And maybe mm-hmm. that can just continue, but I don't know. It seems kind of soulless. It seems kind of unrewarding to have to deal with a mainstream that you have nothing in common with, and it means nothing to you. I mean, look at you with these catalogs where you have to deal with that mutilated language. I mean, do people want to live like that? I mean, I don't think so.
No, I mean, it's terrible. And if I want to see, I mean, I still like to see classic movies or movies I haven't seen yet on screen in film projections. I love to see that, but I have to, as we say in German, to swallow the toad. You know, I have to dare this barbed wire of stupidity. So, and this doesn't feel well, you know. I mean, it just diminishes my joy of going there. I mean, certainly I'm autistic enough that I can go there and say, okay, I don't care about anything. I want to have my Eisenstein on the screen, okay? And I can enjoy it. But still, it's not the same feeling when you are connected with the culture, when you feel that what is going on here is not tainted by this alienating stupidity. So you see, it's not a very satisfying situation I'm describing here. I'm just trying to find hope, you see, in the people who will always be there, who have the urge to create and who always will find a connection to the great figures of the past. It happens automatically because there is such a thing as masters, right? I mean, this is even if you debate sometimes whether this or that work of a master is of lesser or bigger value, or if this is an underrated master or so. But this is important for me to assume and if you love an art, you will always say that. You will say there are directors who are masters and directors who are decent and directors who are bad. And the same goes for poets and musicians and for painters and anything. And I think those people who live now and create, and the people from the future, they will find it, you know, they will recognize it. They will see these people were valued for a reason, you see. And it's a pity, you know, that we do not have a culture that agrees on these people should be, you know, valued, you know, or worshipped or regarded with importance. But this is the way it is, you see. So it will be a task of the few, a task of the few to carry on a torch of sorts. You know, I'm getting a bit, a bit pathos here, right?
Well, it's true, though. I think this is something that you always have to bear in mind, because we can despair talking about the masses and popular culture and so on. You've always got to remember, it's basically always been like this. The masses are fucking stupid. I mean, yeah, they've got good instincts about some things. If they'd been listened to regarding immigration, for example, they would have, yeah, sure. And even architecture, I think that the masses, you can probably trust them to judge a beautiful building from some awful monstrosity. But on anything intellectual, you cannot trust the masses. And the thing is that you don't have to, because, well, okay, you kind of, right, okay. I'll just say this. There's a natural separation that occurs, and it even occurs at school. It probably occurs in kindergarten, between people who are, you know, cerebral, who are thinkers, and people who aren't, people who are the masses. And I don't want to seem contemptuous of them, because I'm not. I just think it's important to recognize this division, because once you recognize this division, then you can start reacting sensibly to the situation. If you try to bring the masses along with something, it's not going to work. It's not going to happen. This is the whole thing with the meme about the griller. Hold on, I'll get it for people so that people know what I'm referring to. It's a hilarious meme because it's so true. Hold on a minute. Yeah. Right. Yes, this one. Now, this. Now,
yeah, I remember.
It's hilarious. And the guy's not a villain, right? We've got to remember this.
No, not at all.
But the point is that relates to politics. You know, the idea is that you've just told him some, like Hunter Biden's laptop or something, and he replies with that. So yeah, that relates to politics, but it really relates to all cerebral life, because you could have been talking about an artistic master. You just saw this incredible painting last night or something, and he just replies with those same words, because all he's actually interested in is the grilling and the game last night, the soccer, the football game.
Right.
No matter what it is,
you can remove the guy now.
Okay. So whether it's an artistic masterpiece, a political theory, or a scientific achievement, it's just going to wash off him. And I think so it's important to bear this in mind, because it simplifies the task of dealing with the world, I think. It's the same thing with education. This is why I think education should be streamed. You know, you shouldn't be teaching all the kids together, because they're fundamentally different. But yeah, so you've got the normies, the NPCs, the masses, and then you've got everyone else. And it's probably about 10% of people who are not like that. And again, I don't want to seem like complacent or full of myself, because I'm well aware that the normie, the masses, they have qualities that I lack. It is actually, and that's not false modesty, it's really the truth. I am very aware of it. But this truth still remains, that they will not understand or have any interest in certain things. And I think that we have to accept that. And then we can just talk about the other people who are like us. Even that woman, the guide that you talked about, she's sort of in the middle. She's kind of interested in higher culture, but not quite, because really she needs everything to be done. She needs all her thinking done for her by other people.
this is the problem. I mean, the thing is, I don't even feel threatened or concerned by the masses, because this kind of stuff we are talking about is like a natural selection, and only, you know, a little part of the population will be interested in it. But then I think of the people who run the cultural institutions and system. And then you have exactly this, the midwits. I mean, yes, you have people who are, the people who are on the cerebral side more, and they're sort of interested in culture, and some of them may, they try to find some meaning in it, you know. These are people, I mean, even the people who subscribe to all these stupid progressive ideologies, at least they are people who need some meaning in their life. They need something to believe in, and even if it's something stupid like trans rights or so, right? But the problem is that this kind of type has occupied this cultural system to an extent that ruins it, you know, that drags it down. And this is what I'm worried about, you know, that there's a kind of shallow conformist sector of the cerebral, more cerebral people, you know, who may even have some sort of art or film appreciation, but they are too shallow, you know, they're too ideological, and they take it into hostage, you see. They insult people like me. I'm sorry, I feel really insulted when I read this kind of genderized versions, when I read this kind of ideology. I mean, it's even like the guide, you know, in the museum, the way she presented this exhibition, you almost felt like she needed an excuse. Why are we showing this in the first place? And the excuse is, oh, there are lots of progressive ideas in it, apart from the crazy reactionary ideas in it. You see? So this is the thing that institutions, they have nothing else to do but spout this shallow ideology, and this is what it is about, you see. And there's another example that comes to my mind. I don't want to go too much into it, but just as another example is that there is a German film organization which has been existing for decades, and they have also lots of ideological changes, and they had a prize they would reward to people who excelled, you know, in the German film industry. And now they had some academic do a study how many of those people who got the prize from this institution were involved in the Nazi regime. And they found about 2,000 people who they thought they were naughty because they were members of the Nazi party, or they were sort of running along with it. And so they posthumously declared that they are taking away the honor, the prizes of honor. You know what I mean? I hope I chose the right words, you know?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And most of those people, now all of these people have been dead for decades, and most of these people are not known today. They're like camera pioneers or film producers, and they did valuable things for German film industry. So they got a prize from this institution, and only two of them are really well known today. And one is an actor you might not know in England. His name was Heinz Rühmann, and he continued to be very popular from the 1930s to the 1960s or so. And as a kid, I loved him. And his prize was also, what's the word, taken away posthumously because he was involved. He was very cozy with the Nazi regime in that era. And the other one is Leni Riefenstahl. And now the thing is, the point is, you know, these people, I mean, first, Heinz Rühmann, he was a great actor. He appeared in countless beloved classics of German cinema, countless, right? And he's one of the few who is not forgotten today. And Leni Riefenstahl, say about her what you will, her films, they were very important for development of the art of movies, no? I mean, she made propaganda films and she made the Olympic film, but these were important films. So what's the point, you know? What is valued here, you know? The only thing that matters is, do they conform to today's ideology? The question is not, have they contributed to the art of cinema? Have they not contributed to the culture of cinema in Germany? But are they conform to today's ideology?
And it's like posthumously, they've been punished.
Yeah, they're punished. They're posthumously punished, you know, for not conforming to today's ideology. And I said this as an example. I wrote a short piece about it, that this is the pestilence of all those cultural institutions today, that they seem only, the thing is, they need to justify their existence because people don't know what culture is about anymore. It seems like culture, everything has to be about the progressive ideology. And it's not just cultural institution, it's any institutions. I mean, even if it's the military or whatever, you know, or during COVID, the medical institutions, you know? And they need to, you know, do what they are made for. But the cultural institutions, it's like people don't get what culture is for. You need to explain it to them. You need to excuse it to them. And then you need a guy to tell you, yes, but there are some progressive things about it. This is why we can even show this today. You know what I mean? And this is really a pestilence. I mean, this is just shallow people taking over who don't have a real idea, who have a very, very narrow idea what culture is about. This is the problem. And the masses, them, I don't care.
Culture, for them, culture is a club. And to be part of it, you have to conform to certain ideas. And if you don't, then you can't be part of it. So you'll be deleted. You'll be... I hate to use the word unpersoned, but your work will be forgotten. That's what they want. Again, someone like that woman, the tour guide at the museum, I'm pretty sure she would want this stuff ideally to be forgotten, but she'll remember it as long as she has to. But ideally, this stuff would be forgotten, and I think it's a sort of religious impulse to purify, to cleanse society morally of bad thinkers. I don't know where to go from that. I mean, they're just tedious. It's the mentality of a midwit.
Yeah, much of what I see in this exhibition I mentioned, right? I mean, of course, it has a historical context. Some of it is sort of dated. You see, there are some ideas that have been tried out and didn't work so well. But the thing is, it's not just a museum piece for me. Some things I see there, you know, some ideas I see expressed in the paintings, they have beauty, they have power. They make me think of, isn't there anything there today apart, you know, from that the artist had some sort of egalitarian ideas, you see? I mean, this is what you would emphasize, you know, the progressive side of all that we see here. And I think this is the least interesting thing for me in most of the things I see there. And there's so much more, you know. I mean, there's so much more, and this is this narrow concept of culture, you know. Also, this, you know, what I hate, this is this pretense that all culture has to be left wing and progressive, you know, and all culture has to serve a left wing and progressive cause, and all cultured people have to be like that. This is what this program signaled to you very aggressively now, you know. This is a very aggressive signaling. If you want to enjoy, you know, Eisenstein movies on screen or this exhibition, you have to be for trans rights, you know, or you have to whatever. You see?
Yeah.
You have to hate. You have to hate the Freedom Party. You have to, you know, and this is a very aggressive, I mean, signaling by telling you if you don't like it, stay out. You know. But I say okay. But I think this. You understand what I mean? I find this depressing, yeah, alienating and depressing, and it should be, and I have a hope it will be gone, you know. Nothing is forever. Ideologies come and go. Sometimes people make fun of ideologies of the past, you know. They look into art catalogs of the past, and then they make fun of certain ideas and languages, but I say you too will pass. This is a hope that remains within me, that I may live to see that this shit will not last forever and something better will come. Not necessarily that we go back to something, but something more intelligent, something less rigid, something less ugly. I mean, how could this not be possible? I hope for that. Yeah? But in my lifetime, I have only seen getting things worse. Yeah? I mean, and there were already annoying things 20 years ago, and they got worse and worse and worse, right? Maybe there's one point when they have reached the peak and then it will fall and reverse. I don't know. I'm not giving up hope, you see.
Well, it's a fashionable idea just now in our circles that wokery is dying out, that it's being put away. I really think that's been overstated. I think in America, it's probably on the way out. And that will have effects over here. But it will be slow. I think that for now, I mean, I think it's probably as strong as ever in Britain.
Is it, yeah?
Every single day I see another example of it. A funny thing, actually, about Alien Earth is that there isn't much wokery in it. That was actually not a complaint I had about it. I had 100 other complaints about it. But I don't want to go back into that. I'm just bringing it up as an example of this. I do think that in America, this stuff is kind of dying out. But in Britain, it's everywhere. I really don't know what... I mean, I agree with you, and it won't last forever. It can't last forever. And if I thought it could, then I wouldn't even talk about it anymore because it would just depress me. I think it's limited. It's not going to last forever. And I actually don't think that there's another 10 years in it. I don't think it can last another 10 years. I don't think this whole system, this whole way of life that we have, I don't think it can last another 10 years. But that's very broadly. I mean, the mass immigration, the multiculturalism, the feminism, the trans, the LGBT, all of that. I don't think it can last another 10 years. I think something is going to give massively within the next 10 years. Probably a lot sooner than that, I think. But for now, the British state is as woke as it ever was. They're still, and the BBC, you know, that they're still obsessed with this stuff. And this is the problem of the Midway. We talked about the masses, but you're right. The actual source of all this, or the sustainers of all this, is the Midwits. It's the people.
The Midwit is the enemy. Yeah. The tall Midwit. Yeah.
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 And we see it all the time on Twitter.
Yeah. I know I'm aware that in Great Britain this wokery thing is really massive and horrible, Orwellian. It isn't that bad in Austria. Our state isn't that woke. I see that it's receding. In Germany, depends where you are. If you're in Berlin, you get fist fucked by wokery. in East part of East Germany, not so much. This is where AfD gets most of votes.
That should be a t-shirt. I went to Berlin and all I got was fist fucked by wokery.
Right. No, I mean, I tell you, they have there in the subway, they have this voice announcing the next station. And I think they picked a guy who deliberately sounds as gay as you can imagine. It's so gay. You feel like you're gliding on Vaseline, your ballerina gliding I don't have comparisons, but okay, so much for that. But in Austria, in the state isn't that terribly woke, but if you go into the realm of culture, then it gets really concentrated, the wokery. And this is painful for a guy for me, you know, who is a guy who is into culture, you know, I like culture, I need culture, I'm a guy who, but I feel excluded there, you know, I go into this area and it's, you see, I have nothing to choose. On one side, I have heard the dumb mainstream idiocy, and then when I want to go and see something more, you know, highbrow, then I get into the realm of ugly, woke, or however you call it, ideology. So only thing that is left for me is my own, internet bubble where I consume stuff all on my own, or, you know, where I have friends who share the same interests and so, and maybe tiny events of people who are like-minded and all that. But otherwise, you know, it's really hard, you see. And this is what makes me sad, is that while the general culture in Austria is not that woke, but when you go into the cultural domain, there you encounter it. And this is what makes it especially stupid, you know. And it also becomes a process where people who enter this area are pre-selected. So more and more people are drawn to it, and it gets worse and worse. And then you have this cultural scene who thinks they're also clever, they're also, you know, left wing, and also they are detached from reality. You know, there are guys who get in there, they are shallow, they are blind by ideology, and they're also detached by reality. And I think this also mars their cultural mission. You know, I mean, you understand what I mean? It's replacing almost what culture should be for. The ideology is replacing the culture. And then you have a cultural elite which constantly is playing the... They still have the authority. You see, a cultural elite traditionally has an authority in a society. You see, even for people who do not care so much about them. This is what accepted culture is about. So there may be masses who like grilling, but they still accept there's a certain authority of people who, you know, write and think and make music and whatever. And people go along with it and accept it, you see. Or certain kind of people, certain, let's say, bourgeois layers of society accept it and as authorities. And these authorities have become all stupid left-wingers. And the people who believe that culture is good, you should participate in culture, they just adopt these beliefs because it's a sort of social signifier, you see, to adopt these progressive beliefs. Yeah.
I think this is one of the worst parts of it, is how it swallows up everything else. So everything... Oh, you've switched your camera back on. Right. Okay.
This was just a mistake, right?
Just a mistake, okay. How it swallows... Like, the wokery swallows up everything. So everything becomes about signaling your allegiance to this ideology, and that you really believe in it, and you're forward it, you're advancing it. So every film, even from the past, as you said earlier, even films from the past have to then be seen through that lens. And you see this, you hear about this, like someone will say, the ancient Aztecs, where they actually had transgender people, or you know, whatever. So cavemen in ancient the steppes, you know, whatever. They had a third gender, so they were actually like us. They were just like us today, really. Or the Native Americans, they've got the two spirits, whatever it is. And the point is that everything is about that now. Whether I mean it's feminism or gay, but especially trans. And bear in mind, it's easy to forget this. Nobody was talking about trans stuff in 2010, 15 years ago. It was a tiny thing. I know that I was corrected on this matter by someone who was at school. He was at high school then, and he said, yeah, they mentioned it then in 2010. Okay, sure. But the point is that in 2005, they didn't even mention it there. In 2000, they didn't mention it at high school. It just wasn't a thing. And in 2010, people were still laughing. They were making jokes about, you know, the guy who likes wearing a dress at the weekends or whatever, because it was funny, it used to be a common joke, because it is inherently hilarious. Back in the good old days when it was innocent and it was just a guy wearing a dress, it was funny.
The joke is telling itself, you know. It's a joke.
I know.
That tells itself.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, the point is that the 10, 15 years ago, nobody knew about this stuff. It wasn't a part of the culture. And we viewed history without that lens. It had nothing to do with how we looked back at history. Now, it's everything. It's how, apparently, it's how we view everything. Well, my point is just that this is something that moves very quickly. It changes very quickly, and it's painful for us here and now to have to live with this, because it's just so irritating, and also it's so delusional. I mean, I don't believe for a second that the Aztecs had the same attitude to transgenderism. that some blue-haired 20-year-old has today. That is just absolutely preposterous. I mean, they were cutting out people's hearts, for fuck's sake. It's completely, completely radically different culture. But I guess that's part of the point, really. So, well, they were so different from us, and yet, they also had transgender people. So you can't wait. I just think all this is terrible.
Yeah, I mean, culture, human beings need also meaning, right? And culture is a sort of way to create a meaning, you know, a collective meaning for people. I think this is basically the simplest formula for it. And I think, yeah, today, in a way, the products of culture, they are not as good enough to create that meaning. I mean, people have lost the ability to find meaning in products of culture. So they need to impose a different meaning, which is the shallow ideological meaning that they put on it. No, so I get it, you know. People want to live for something good, you know. They want to be good. They want to have an, you know, idea that is above them, you know. And even if it's just some lousy, whatever, transgender idea or this mutilation of the language I told you about, which is so moronic, you know. It's an insult. I have I said before, it's an insult for every thinking human being, but still there is an idea in it of a meaning of equality or whatever. I mean, I'm not the person that gets excited about equality. I don't get it, you know. But some people do, and for some people it creates a meaning. And this is the only thing that is left. But they cannot do without anything at all, you know. There has to be some sort of transcendence, even if it's as shallow as that one, right? But I think it has to do with a loss of ability to find meaning in products of culture, you know, be it art, painting, music, and so on. Yeah, and in the end, only this ideological purposes remain. I'm afraid I'm starting to repeat myself a bit here, but you know, this gets me very angry. So I get into ranting modes.
That's okay. I think we're in agreement, and I do. That's another point, that all of this is a replacement for something else. I do think that if people the midwit echelon, I think if they felt an allegiance to, for example, their country, their people, then they wouldn't need this stuff. I think this is a substitute for something else, and of course, it would have been religion once. It would have been Christianity. Now it's this, and it is very shallow, and it is very delusional. It doesn't marry up with real life, but they've got nothing else. So yeah, I agree. It is a thing. There have been a few super chats, so I'll put those pages now.
So okay. I'd say let's do the super chats now, and then you know we come to a closure. Okay. We have been talking almost 3.5 hours now. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Mm-hmm. Jen et al. very good. Says, how do you rate the significance of Adam Curtis's documentary work? And do you have any recommendations for a German language documentarian, documentary maker? Have you heard of Adam Curtis?
Yeah, okay. I can answer this quickly. I have seen several documentaries by Adam Curtis. They are very well done. They are clever, but they are also never really getting to the point. I find it a bit frustrating, and I find them a bit too clever. And I think there's a much superior German filmmaker, which is called Lutz Dambeck. And his most famous film is called The Net, which is about Ted Kaczynski. He made a film called Over Games, which is about the re-education of Germans after World War II. He made the films about the connection between art and ideology, also both in the Third Reich and in GDR. And I think he's brilliant and superior than Adam Curtis, my opinion. I think it's mandatory viewing. Lutz Dambeck is his name.
All right.
I always get a bit frustrated by Adam Curtis, and it's all way too long and self-indulgent. And I think his analyses are often just plain. They hint at something, but they never really, really get to the core. So I'm not such a great fan.
Right.
Unlike Lutz Dambeck, who's really great. I recommend him.
Okay. Open Borders says, well done, Martin, on making remigration a mainstream idea. I think you might be confusing Martin Lichtmess with Martin Selner.
No, it wasn't
Open
me.
Open Borders. No.
Hey, this is funny.
they are very good friends, the two Martins, and they do a podcast together, don't you?
Yeah, we have a podcast called Auf eine Melange. Melange is a coffee with milk you have in Vienna. And then we have chats, which are more, you know, on the philosophical side. But I have nothing to do with making the word remigration popular. It's all Martin's credit, the other Martin's credit.
Yes, yes. And he's done incredibly well with that. And I really applaud him and his efforts. So Open Borders goes on. Most people don't realize that countries like Austria and Ireland have very small populations and can be overrun very quickly with the births of literally 1 year by countries like Nigeria. This is a huge problem for small countries, and it's why I'm also worried about Scotland as well, which has a small population. It doesn't take much to radically change the population in these countries. It's not like England or Germany or America. It's a huge problem. Lichtmess, do you want to say anything about that?
Well, of course, I basically agree. I mean, I heard that there are now 9 million people living in Austria. When I was a kid, it was 6 million. I mean, it's a huge population growth. It's not just a large part is immigrants, but also population growth, and I see that it just makes the concrete also grow. You know, I see less green, I see more houses built, more landscapes destroyed, more nature being destroyed, more crowded, everything becomes more crowded. I just dislike, this is also a part, I think an underrated part of immigration, you know, not just that it changes the population, but that it also takes away space, you know, to live, and it makes the world uglier.
Yes. Yeah, you've told me about places that you knew, that you've known all your life, and they're now being built on. And that's it's horrible. The same in Scotland. It's the same in my hometown of Linlithgow and Bowness, where my mum grew up. It's so much building going on, and it's not Scottish people who are living in these new houses. As far, I mean, it can't be, because there aren't that many of them. So it has to be foreigners, and it's just terrifying.
It doesn't seem to stop. I mean, it's like a cancer. It doesn't seem to stop. You have to grow. I'm a complete degrowth person, you know? A degrowth person.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And then finally, Angerad Celtic, Denise the Celt, says, and she's been active in both the Rumble and Odyssey chats, incidentally. And she says, I thank both Woz and Martin for yet another wonderful, fascinating conversation. Of course, cameras off when the two handsomest men on the internet are discussing film. That's the embodiment of irony. Heavy sigh. I am sorry, Angerad, Denise. We wanted to do it on camera, but unfortunately, Lichtmess is using an antiquated laptop. And that's why you should all donate to him, so that he can buy a new laptop next, so that we can be on camera next year.
Yes, thank you, Denise. She's one of our most faithful listeners, and she always says these very nice things about us. So I'm really flattered every year to hear that. So thank you very much, Denise, for that.
Yes, and thank you. It was a very generous super chat as well. So thank you, Denise. So Lichtmess is going to be returning to his Substack next year. And so I'll link to that for people again, because that is a way that you can support him. And I think he would very much appreciate that. So here we go on Twitter as well. I'll put it in there as well, just in case anyone missed it the first time. Hold on a second. There we go. Right. So with all of that said, Lichtmess, do you have any final words to leave people with?
Don't lose hope. Find as many white pills as you can. Be happy and creative. Keep on fighting. Is that a good message? I mean, I have a reputation of being a very dark person. You read Gothic Pops because I like Gothic music. I also have a reputation for being black-pilled, but I just want to say something positive for once. But I believe what I said, so this is my message for you and for the next new year.
All right. Well, I would echo all of those sentiments. I think it's good advice. All right. Well, in that case, we'll end it there. I'll be back in 20 minutes with the AMA for tonight, and that should be fun. But in the meantime, I always really look forward to Lichtmess's appearance on Millennial. So, Martin Lichtmess, thank you for treating us all to another dose of Lichtmess wisdom and learning on Millennial 2025.
Thank you, Rosie, for having me on again. It has been a long and valid tradition, and I'm glad I was here again on your fantastic Millennial Festival. Nothing like it in our sphere, and it's good it goes on.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay, I'll see you all soon. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.